Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Let's talk about the backlash. Besides yourself, like, were any actors on the blacklist from participating in this movie?
Lawrence Cook, who played the lead, never got another featured role. Same thing with Paula Kelly. Okay.
That was the police officer? The police officer I'd seen in a couple movies.
Police officer, I think people identified him as a cop.
Right.
So he continued to have a
very prosperous career.
He still got roles.
Yeah,
now, Paula Kelly was the young lady, right?
No, Paula Kelly was the homie queen.
Okay.
The prostitute.
Okay. Right. So the recruiting process to get those actors on board to play these roles, I mean, that wasn't hard. You just kind of, what Ivan put out there, hey, I'm trying.
We auditioned in L.A. and New York and here. A number of the roles were played by Chicago actors.
Okay.
Paul Butler, for instance, played the head gangbanger. Paymoon Rami, and his name at that time was Anthony Ray. He played Shorty the Dope Dealer.
Oh.
Okay. And there were other minor roles played by Chicago actors.
Okay.
And, for instance, the riot scene, those weren't professional actors working as extras. They were people from the immediate Gary neighborhood.
Because you were, that scene was, you could tell you were in the grid of it. The camera was right there in the middle, and it seemed like straight chaos. Was that done in Chicago? That was done
in? That was in Gary.
That was done in Gary.
Yeah.
Right, and so.
The reason it's so authentic is that the cops were not actors. Mm-hmm. They were Gary police in uniform, off duty.
Okay.
And these police were the same ones that patrolled the neighborhood. So the extras had a shot at going upside a car's head.
Had a free shot at
Yeah, so we almost had a real riot going on.
Okay, yeah, because I could tell that, like I said, it was real grit and it was a lot of chaos going on.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's day, Friday, September 30th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our third study session on the late Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. The audio segment that you heard, an interview Mr. Greenlee conducted back in 2012, talking about some of the casting for the film, as well as talking about some of the difficulties that some of the actors encountered because of their involvement in his project. I had never heard that before. I'm not surprised, but that is, fascinating just to get more details. Again, system of white supremacy. Whites are not ignorant, and they do respond to any counter-racist efforts that might potentially disrupt their empire of terrorism. They do respond. So just thought that would be great to kind of keep that in mind as we proceed. We are in Chapter 9, this week. I think from last week where we left off at Dan Freeman, the main character, he's already left his position at the CIA. He's back in Chicago in his social worker career. We heard about his partnership with Joy, and he just had his violent confrontation with the Cobras, their three main leaders. He's going to show them how to really get at Whitey. That is where we are picking up at this week. I think, again, if we could just be mindful for anti-blackness, the conflicts, internal conflicts amongst black people, how that plays out within the text, something to kind of keep in mind as we move forward. Without further ado, we will get started. Context of white supremacy, again, Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door, audio segment number one.
Chapter 9. Gentlemen, Stevens said in a board meeting in his best advertising executive manner, I have splendid news. He paused dramatically, sweeping the room with his smiling gaze, allowing the suspense to build. Dan has made contact with the Cobras. There was a sudden silence. Stevens, puzzled at this reaction, looked uneasily around the room. He patted his pocket handkerchief, fingered his pipe, and cleared his throat. Freeman sat quietly. He was not puzzled. Dan, this contact with the Cobras, Stevens had said just prior to the meeting, will really sell the board members on you. Not, he added hastily, that they aren't already, but no one expected a contact with the Cobras so soon after you joined us. This is really good news. Freeman watched their ambivalence fill the room like a white velvet fog. White liberals to a man, with the single exception of Burkhart, the hard-headed business member. Among them, Roger Thompson, professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, a professional white liberal who had devoted a career to proving that the inequities of Negroes were social and cultural rather than racial. Stevens, an amateur white liberal turned pro. They can forgive a nigger almost anything other than competence, thought Freeman behind his mask. They want their choice to have been an act of charity for a Negro not quite up to the job. They want me to fumble, stumble, turn to them for help. They would like the Washington Freeman. He was a good boy. Part of them wants me to vindicate their choice of a spade for the position, but another part wants me to prove once again that it is spade incompetence, not white racism, which is responsible for the scene. They'll use me, but they'll never like me. That is good news, Steve, said Professor Thompson. But are you certain this is a positive contact? Stevens, sensing difficulties, threw the ball to Freeman. Dan? Freeman regarded a point midway across the polished mahogany conference table, frowning in thought. Then he leaned forward sincerely and looked deeply into Professor Thompson's contact lenses. Of course, Professor, it is too early to be positive. I advocate caution at this point, and I'm moving slowly, but I made the first contact with gang leaders several weeks ago in their pool room headquarters. I've played pool with them almost nightly, and they visited my apartment several times since. Visited your apartment? Well, that is a real foot in the door. What are your immediate plans? Standard procedure for a while. Gain their trust and confidence. Offer them an adult male to trust and admire, since they are almost all from broken homes and have none otherwise. he motioned to Stevens' colored secretary, who moved around the table gracefully, placing a folder in front of each member. "You'll recognize the concept as your own, Professor. I've taken the liberty of including copies of the article you did concerning it for Atlantic a few years back in these folders. In addition, there are biographic character sketches of the three gang leaders, Dean, Davis, and Scott, plus shorter ones of several other key gang members. There is the table of organization of the gang, including the chain of command, and a brief history of the Cobras as a ghetto social institution. My own plans for the gang, subject, of course, to change, are also included." He watched them look through the folder from behind his Grecian mask, a black Prometheus among the gods, who had stolen the secret of fire from Olympus by the Potomac and was teaching its use to his people. Not the fire next time, he thought, but the fire right now. How long before they chained him to let the black and white vultures tear at his liver? Professor Thompson looked up. "I notice you plan a sports program for the Cobras. Hasn't that approach been pretty much discredited in reaching street corner society?" "In general, yes, Professor. However, I think it might tend to work with the Cobras. As you know, they emphasize sports far more than usual for a street gang. Almost every member is a pretty good athlete, and they still call themselves the Cobras ASC, Athletic and Social Club. And the gang leaders were all star athletes until they dropped out of high school. I thought I might start with a program which would appeal to both their combativeness and athletic ability." He paused. "I'm seriously considering organizing a judo club." "Judo?" exclaimed Burkhart. "Isn't that asking for trouble? Think of what they could do with that knowledge in gang fights." "On the contrary, Mr. Burkhart, the judoka has a strict discipline intrinsic in the training that he will avoid a fight whenever possible, and when offered no choice, restrain himself." Then, striking at Burkhart's soft spot of fanaticism concerning guns and marksmanship, he continued, "It's almost identical to the principle employed in weapons training. By teaching gun discipline and a respect for the weapon and its potential, you tend to reduce rather than increase the possibility of its indiscriminate use." "Yes, I see what you mean, Freeman. Certainly, I've seen the positive effect of weapons training on antisocial types when I was in the army. It might work at that. I actually got the idea from your article in American Rifleman," said Freeman. "It was in the August issue," said Burkhart, surprised, pleased, and flattered. "You read it?" "I've made it a point to read everything both you and Professor Thompson have written. It gives me an insight in your approach to the Foundation's work." Burkhart relaxed and smiled at Freeman for the first time in his memory. "Got your nose open now, you little motherfucker, and it would really be beautiful if I could talk you into coaching a rifle team made up of the Cobras, but that can wait." They discussed the Cobras for some time and then adjourned the meeting. Later, over luncheon, Stevens expressed his pleasure. "A masterful presentation, Dan. You'd do well in advertising if you ever left the social welfare game. And I couldn't be more pleased in your finally breaking through with Burkhart. I think we've earned another round of martinis. He motioned to the waitress. In the early stages of his training and organization, Freeman often used the street for his classes. He would stand casually on the street corner, hanging out, and pass along his CIA bred knowledge. You already said, Turk, it's firepower, not marksmanship in a firefight. So how come all this jazz about range and wind and that shit? Asked Scott one afternoon. Because everybody has to double up as snipers. Even the cats who can't shoot will have nuisance value. Nobody likes to walk around in the dark and not know when somebody is going to shoot at him. Anyway, like Turk say, ain't nothing to figuring range in a city. The length of a block, distance between lamp poles and telephone poles is all standard, said Dean. In an attack, you'll be on battle sites, 300 yards. It will handle anything you're likely to be shooting at. But for sniper work, you try to figure the range to the inch. He paused to make sure he had their attention. If you were working as a sniper from that corner building and we were the target, how would you figure the range? He let them puzzle it a minute, then asked their resident mathematician. Sugar? I guess I'd estimate by sight from up there. NG, no good. Range estimation at night is always tricky, and with artificial light too? He shook his head. Hell, man, it's simple geometry. You know the height of the building. Yeah, said Scott. Yeah, and I know the distance from the base of the building to here. So, what's the distance of the third side of the triangle? Smiling broadly, Scott gave the range to the inch. That's all right for him, Turk, but what about the rest of us? Stud Davis asked. Nothing to it, Stud. Hips can run it down for you in 10 minutes. Man, I never could do anything with math in school. That's because you never had educational motivation before. Take over, Sugar, and don't let them go until they know how to do it. Then you each pass it along to the cells. Easy. He walked away. Freeman continued to use the streets for his training, but as the weather grew cooler, he would use the pool room after closing or his own apartment. His close relationship with gang leaders was completely in keeping with his cover and only added to his prestige as an active, energetic, and imaginative social worker. He gradually gained their confidence and growing affection, and the masks they wore for the outside world were loosened for Freeman, their personality traits becoming increasingly clear. They had been gifted athletes and had delayed dropping out of high school only because of their love of sports. Dean, the smallest one of them, had not played football, but had been that rarest of American Negro athletes, a distance runner. Few Negroes in the United States have had any taste for duplicating in a distance run the exact kind of pain and endurance they face in their daily lives. But Dean ran as he lived, methodically, impassively, the intensity he hid so well, flashing only at the finish of the race when, head back, teeth bared, he would sprint the last 300 or 400 yards, punishing his black, wiry body, regardless of how far he might be in front or how hopeless his pursuit of a leading opponent. But he seldom lost, except in open meets against older, more experienced men. Ain't but one place in a race, he would say. First place. Second and third don't count. He had a sharp, methodical mind and was temperamentally opposed to making hasty decisions. Let me think about it, he would say when a problem arose, and sometimes days later, when others had forgotten, he would present his opinion, and it would usually be accepted without question. One night, in the pool room, after it had closed, Freeman was discussing the table of organization of the Cobra Underground. Turk, said Dean, that same way we always been. Right, said Freeman. The only change is here, where you had a duplication. He pointed to the blackboard. The organization was already together, and there's no need to change the chain of command or the T&O. Ordinarily, it would take 3 to 5 years to organize an underground organization of this type from scratch, but the Cobras have always been an underground. How do you mean? Asked Dean. What do you think? Countered Freeman. We discussed the characteristics of an underground revolutionary movement last week. Well, secrecy. Not even all the gang members know how big the Cobras is, and the Fuzz sure as hell don't. We got organization and, what's that word you used? Motivation? Yeah, motivation. And we got discipline and we got balls. Right. And there are at least 5 or 6 other gangs who fit that description. Not as well as the Cobras, but well enough for recruitment once our training is complete. Got any idea who they might be? Let's see. The Comanches, the Apaches, the Blood Brothers on the west side, said Stud Davis. The Crusaders and the Tigers, said Dean. The Tigers, said Davis. Man, they don't do nothing but give parties. They even got chicks in the gang, the Tigerettes. You ever try to crash one of them parties? Asked Dean. Man, them chicks as bad as they are. Right, said Freeman. And we can use women. They can often go places and do things men can't do. There are a couple of other possibilities, but those gangs top the list. How many do you figure if we recruit them all, including the Cobras? More than 500, said Scott. Yeah, and what do you think 500 well-trained revolutionaries can do to this town? Turn it inside out, said Davis. They looked at one another, impressed. Shit, Turk, said Dean. You don't play, do you? I sure as hell don't. And not just Chicago, but every city with a ghetto, which is every major city in the North. The members of the recruitment and training cell move out in January. Their cities are already selected, as well as the first gangs they contact. You're going to turn this country upside down, said Dean. Wrong. We're going to turn this country upside down. You really dig the Cobras, don't you, Daddy? Freeman asked him one day as they stood in front of the pool room late one lazy, warm afternoon. The people were moving slowly through the streets, standing in clusters, talking softly, occasionally waving to a friend, sometimes detaching themselves from one group to join another. The ghetto sounds, smells, and colors, white teeth in dark faces below the sunglasses which hid them from the cold, hard world, protection for people born to the sun but forced to live sick society. Yeah, the Cobras the best. Everybody know that. You know, one of the cats moved to New York and they know our rep way out there. Cats start getting bad 'cause he new on the block. You know, to find out if he got any balls. Where you from, nigga? Think you bad? That kind of shit. And he told him he from Chicago and he a Cobra. And man, he owned the block after that. He the leader of a gang there now. Groovy, said Freeman, always alert to potential recruits. If they check out, maybe we can use them for our New York scene. Harlem or Bedford-Stuyvesant? Harlem. Go on. How'd you become a Cobra? I never thought I'd be one. You know, I was really little and skinny then, and I wasn't worth a shit in sports. I got better all of a sudden, but I was never as good as Stud or Hips or Pretty Willie. Them cats can do anything. I was good with my hands, though. He smiled. You know, if you can't fight out here in the streets, you sure better be able to run, and I never been too fast. He did not have great straightaway speed, but he did possess the quality coaches call quickness, great speed of hands, and the ability to change direction instantly. It had made Dean an excellent playmaking basketball guard in spite of his lack of height. I was only about 10 or 11, and the Cobras used to like to watch me fight. Sometimes they set up a fight with somebody. I had good moves even then. Seems like I always knew how to hook. You know, that a tough thing for a little kid to do. The other punch is easy, but a real good hook ain't easy for a little kid. But I had it. They used to talk about my left hand and make bets and stuff. Next thing I know, they make me the mascot. Then they start using me to wiggle through windows and things when they hit a store or something, and then I get to be a Cobra. He said it as if it were the most important thing that had ever happened to him. You ever think there might not be any Cobras one day? Dean looked surprised, then a bit shocked. What you mean? I mean, we could all get wasted. Every one of us. Freeman's gaze swept the entire street, and he motioned to the people there. I mean, all of us. Nobody knows what Whitey might do when the deal goes down. I never thought about that. Dean looked at the people in the street with new interest. Does it scare you? Asked Freeman. I don't know. Does it scare you? He looked at Freeman intently. Hell yeah. But that ain't nothing new. I've been scared all my life. There ain't a nigger living who doesn't know fear. We live in it all our lives, like a fish in water. We just have to learn how to use it. Dean took out a pack of cigarettes and offered Freeman one. He waved his refusal and watched two men across the street, deep in an argument. A crowd was gathering, waiting for the explosion. Freeman pointed to them. They're scared. That's why they might kill one another in a minute. Watch 'em. They were serious now, not loud talking anymore. Their voices low and deadly, and already they had dropped that right foot back and stood aslant one another in a position for instant combat. They kept their hands ready for attack or defense, each awaiting some move from the other. Damn near the deadliest people in the world, thought Freeman, but killing each other all these years instead of the people who put all that fear and anger inside them. Finally, one said something and the other laughed, and they both stood there, their heads flung back, and threw their dark laughter to the sky. The crowd joined in, and others threw in jokes and asides, the smiles broad in their faces, the tension suddenly gone and giving the laughter its force and power. The two men strode into a bar and the crowd moved on to other diversions. They got a blues about that. Laughing to keep from crying, it says, and that about says it. A man could get to be a philosopher listening to the blues. If we ever forget how to laugh, we're finished. You really dig spades, don't you, Turk? Yeah, I feel about spades the way you feel about the Cobras. They're my family. I got a family of 25 million people. He smiled. Ain't no way I can ever be lonely. But he was lonely. His cover, his plans had forced him into himself, and his loneliness ate at him like a cancer. Always the iron control, even when drunk, the cover everything, himself nothing. Afraid even when he cried out in orgasm that he might give something away. Only with the Cobras could he be open, but he knew he used them as well. Sometimes he looked at their faces, trying to etch their features into his memory, knowing that many, if not all of them, would not survive. Knowing also that they had no future otherwise. The endless waiting in the lines, unemployment lines with sullen, blank, black faces at their end. The white man boss in his office, memoranda on his desk to get tougher, cut down the unemployment rolls, forced them out into the streets and into the other lines leading to an employment office where there were jobs only for white faces. Junk, jail, or junk and jail and more junk available for those with the price in the county jail. The guards, the safest pushers in the city. They can't bust you in the slam, the junkies joke between heroin nods. An aborted marriage to a favorite buck and another black baby with no hope and no future in the land of milk and honey, replete with goodies in white plastic cases for God's own children with white plastic faces. They moved toward the pool room, walking slowly through the warm streets. That laughter, baby, is the best insurance Whitey has. Once we stop laughing and singing, stop killing each other and start killing him, forget it. He was amazed at how quickly they learned. He pushed them ruthlessly, relentlessly, and each time they reached the saturation point, they swelled to absorb more. He had figured on 18 months to 2 years, but gradually he felt sure they could begin the next summer. He did not allow himself to think of it after so many years of lonely planning that perhaps now it was only a matter of months. They reached the pool room and walked inside, past the never-silent television set. He glanced at the set and watched Ernie Banks wiggle his spikes solidly into the dirt of the batter's box and set his long, lithe body for the pitch. They walked to the table in the rear and began to shoot. Turk, lot of the cats 1A. What happen when they get called? They go underground? No. Shit, the Army is our postgraduate course. The best training ground we have. They can teach us the skills we need in a fraction of the time I can. When they get a call, have them check with you. Then we go over what we need and they go and volunteer for the next call. That way they can pick their training and not get stuck in some unit that's a waste for us. Armor is a waste, unless it's armored infantry. You know what we need? Skill with small arms, demolitions, small unit tactics. He paused and smiled. There's a certain poetry in Whitey training us to mess with him. Every black cat in Vietnam is a potential asset for our thing. Whitey knew what he was doing when he wouldn't let us fight in the Second World War. He paused to line up a shot, stroked, and missed. He watched Dean as he chalked his cue. You know, American white folks got more nerve than anybody. They call them gooks and us niggers out there in Vietnam and in Korea when I was there. And they don't see any reason why the gooks and niggers shouldn't kill one another for Whitey's benefit. The hang-up is that's exactly what's happening. You can't criticize success, now can you? They pretty smart, ain't they? Smiled Dean. Don't know whether they're smart or we're stupid. Maybe a little bit of both. The discipline, always good, tightened and the pride increased. No longer flamboyant, but quieter, cooler. The Cobras walked tall and ready, afraid of nothing. They even lost interest in pot. Tell the cats to turn on every now and then. They get like suburban Boy Scouts and everybody will get suspicious, he told Dean. Then he smiled, remembering pot had become as popular in the suburbs as swallowing goldfish or college panty raids had once been. They drilled endlessly in weapons training, unarmed combat, demolition theory. He taught them the theory of resistance to torture. Most people can't stand up under it, and there's no shame if you can't. But if you give in too quick, they won't believe you and they'll keep it up. You have to hold out long enough to convince them the info you give out is for real. Otherwise, the scene goes on and you haven't gained a thing. What you have to remember is the cats who torture enjoy it. They don't want you to quit too soon, so you have to hold on long enough for them to get their kicks. Then tell them what they want to hear. Just Whitey all over again. You know, when he's putting you down, he don't dig it if you take low too soon. They gradually built up a network of safe houses, arms caches, and message drops. Only Freeman knew the entire network. The rest were divided between Dean, Scott, and Davis. He tried to figure a way for training with handguns, then dismissed the idea as one which would attract too much attention. Besides, the kind of fighting he had in mind would find that kind of weapon almost useless. Professor Thompson, who was writing a book on the activities of the Foundation, decided to add a chapter concerning Freeman's work in contacting and defusing the Cobras. Freeman was becoming known as a bright young man in social work. He was named as an eligible bachelor in Ebony's annual listing, pictured leaning suavely against his lotus. Since he was careful to direct credit toward Stevens, remaining modest and unassuming, refusing to flirt with the white women at the integrated Hyde Park cocktail parties, arriving early and leaving early before the potent cocktails might provoke an unpleasant scene, always appearing with women dark enough not to be mistaken for white, he was pointed out as an example of a Negro who was making it in American society. No one could imagine that Freeman, tame, smug, and self-satisfied, would ever rock the boat, much less suspect that he planned to sink it. Chapter 10. The first time Freeman hinted what he planned for them, Stud picked it up immediately. Man, you know the first time shit like that start happening, they gonna come looking for the Cobras. No, they won't, replied Freeman. No? How come? We about the only gang over here with that kind of balls, and the fuzz know it. They won't come looking for you because junkies don't do what we're going to do. And starting very soon, the Cobras is going to be the most turned on gang in Chicago. The street gang wars in New York in the late 50s, which threatened the entirety of the city and which were increasingly difficult for the police to control, ended primarily for one reason. Junk. Junkies don't fight except in desperation for a fix. The word spread among the police that the King Cobras were toying with horse. With some relief, the police waited for the addiction to take hold. It would mean an increase in petty theft, but as long as it did not spill outside the ghetto, and it was nigger stealing from nigger, it meant no extra work. The symptoms were there. Upon being searched, there was an increasing amount of gang members with hypo scars on the forearm, the pupils dilated by drugs. Police were informed when receiving their cut from dope pushers that the Cobras were becoming excellent customers. The scars were from unsterilized hypodermic needles, the dilated pupils from pot. The heroin was refined and resold in New York at a slight loss or a profit, depending on whether the narcotics men had busted an incoming shipment from abroad. The Cobras overnight became a non-bopping gang. Still dangerous when their turf was invaded, but no longer aggressive. Police duty in their area became almost tame, consisting of the collection of graft, confinement of crime and violence to the area, and the head whippings, which are routine for any cop working in the ghetto. Freeman's contact with the gang had been duly noticed, and he was personally commended for his positive influence at a meeting of the board of directors of the foundation. The pacifying influence of heroin was not mentioned. Freeman did not assign a street worker to the Cobras, but worked with them himself. He often wondered at the reaction of the board had they known what his program of rehabilitation actually entailed. The gang organization was perfect for his purpose. The Cobras had already been an underground organization, visible only in their moments of violence, closed off to the outside world otherwise. Freeman built on the original organizational structure, following the same chain of command, utilizing the already rigid discipline and introducing refinements borrowed from the French Maquis, the Israeli, the Cypriot, and Yugoslav underground movements. The training proceeded more rapidly than he had anticipated, since for the first time in most of their lives, the members of the King Cobras had educational motivation. Stud remained Freeman's and the Cobras' field commander, and Dean revealed why he had become the gang leader. He had a tendency to shuck the world, to pretend mental stagnation, while in actuality he possessed a methodical, analytical mind much more cautious and steady than that of the mercurial Davis. Freeman had to fight against hero worship, since he was the only outsider who had ever demonstrated a genuine interest in them as human beings. "Look, goddammit, there ain't no head niggers in this outfit. The whole scene is designed to have the man below move up at least 3 steps whenever necessary. If I go, Doodaddy takes over and right on down the line. Every nigger revolt in the history of America has ended when they wasted the head nigger. That won't happen with us. I am the man and you do what I say, but when they get to me, don't look back, dig? No tears, no flowers, just keep fucking with Whitey." He spent a great deal of time with his 3 lieutenants in his apartment, and when they relaxed in the new surroundings, they asked exhaustive questions about each of his paintings, carvings, and sculptures. One day, he pointed out quietly that the majority of his collection had been created by men who were not white. They devoured whatever he told them about the history of their people in America. Somehow, they had attained a pride in themselves as human beings based on their contempt and hatred of the white man and a stubborn pride in their toughness and defiance. Now he told them that theirs was a history and tradition of which they could be proud. Man, we took everything they laid on us. Slavery, lynching, segregation, the worst damn jobs, the worst damn food, and come up swinging. We've been on our ass, but we never on our knees, and that's what the white man don't understand. He thinks it's the same thing. He told them about their history, where in Africa their ancestors had lived, the cultural heritage the white man had destroyed, forbidding them their language, their music, their sculpture, carving and painting, their dancing, and giving them nothing in return. No, not even their jive white man's religion. Less than 1/6 of the freed men upon emancipation had been allowed to become Christians, and they justified slavery on the basis of converting the heathen. He told them of their heroes and heroines, of the countless slave revolts, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Sojourner Truth, countless other names they had not been taught in the propaganda that passes for American history. He remembered his own introduction to the history of the Negro in America by a proud black teacher of music who, in defiance of the rules, devoted time to teach them some pride in themselves and their people, who taught them to distrust the image the white man thrust at them in the movies, on the radio, and in their history text. He remembered how he had to descend to the bowels of the library in East Lansing, passing the books written by the name American historians in search for the truth about his people. Now he passed it along, each cell meeting devoted part of its time to the history of the American Negro. We got no time for hate. It's a luxury we can't afford. Whitey just stands in the way of freedom, and he has to be moved any damn way we can. He doesn't mean any more than that. All the time he spoke to them of their mission, he was aware of the inconsistencies in his arguments, the humor and horror in what they intended, the hell they would create for their people in the struggle for their freedom. He wondered how long this would last, how long before he began believing each word as if the word of God. Would it be when he finally had the power of life and death, when the resources of the city and perhaps the nation were devoted to finding and destroying him? How long before he saw himself as a black messiah? Freeman knew from the personnel records at the CIA that an agent became burned out when he had no longer had an identity as a distinct personality. After the erosion of the years of cover, constantly becoming someone different, finally wore away what he actually was until he no longer knew what he was. Freeman had been playing roles for whites and finally for everyone. How long before the edges of his cover and those of his personality would blur, merge, and he could no longer tell where one began and the other ended? That was why it was an advantage to be black. There were millions of peoples and races in Europe whose centuries of subservience made them culturally perfect as raw material for spying. The nigger was the only natural agent in the United States, the only person whose life might depend from childhood on becoming what whites demanded yet somehow remaining what he was as an individual human being. Freeman had had years of practice at the game before adopting the cover he had assumed at the CIA and the present cover as a playboy of the Midwestern world. That might save him, but it was important nonetheless that he establish an organization which would survive him. Once they discovered him, he would disappear. There would be no martyr-making trials and no more public assassinations as with Malcolm X. He would just disappear, and the white man, confident in the eternal passivity and stupidity of the Negro, except for rare individual exceptions, would assume that the organization would die with Freeman. It must not be so. He read them their poets and their literature. He played their music. They knew the doo-wops, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, but jazz was something played for white folks in clubs in the Loop or in concert halls. He wondered how some of the jazz musicians would feel if they knew how far away many of their people felt they were. He remembered the days when Negroes in Chicago were allowed to work before the stockyards moved west to the right-to-work law states and before the steel mills and other plants automated, before the railroads cut back and laid off. There was jazz on the South Side played by Negroes for Negroes. Of all those clubs, only the Drexel Hotel Lounge survived. He used expense account money to take them there to hear Miles Davis. Miles had always played the South Side in the Pershing Ballroom and the Smoky Bars on 63rd before they went rock and roll, when he was blowing so much stuff the whites couldn't understand it until one day, after years of neglect, they rediscovered him and he asked what was all the noise. He always played like that. They listened to Miles' records and to Lady Day, Prez, Monk, Diz, and the rest, and began hearing things in jazz that they had heard in rhythm and blues. They listened to down-home blues. He became the father and big brother they had never had, and, although he fought it, he returned their affection and love. He knew this could be a fatal weakness, but he could not help it. He watched them grow now that they had a purpose, and found it sad that there was nothing for them in this land where their ancestors had lived for hundreds of years, except destruction. But in that negative urge to strike out against oppression, they had found something that freed them from their fears and the doubts about themselves and their color. He watched them grow and become more human and knew that their newfound humanity would not inhibit their becoming the killers he was training them to be. He taught them all the tricks of the trade and knew that if he had organized a network as quickly, silently, and efficiently in the field, he would have been commended. They had not been tested, but he had no doubt about their performance once they were. Already, they were impatient to begin. He told them they would begin operating during the coming summer under cover of the inevitable rioting. He knew as surely as the sun rises that the cops who occupied the ghetto would not give up their pastime of whipping niggers' heads in spite of directions from above concerning less physical means of arrest and investigation in the ghetto. They were not convinced, those thick-headed cops, that niggers would tolerate no more head whippings. The cops felt sure that the answer to the riots and the increasing lack of respect for the uniform was more blood, more stitches, more battered kidneys. Leopards do not change their spots, and ghetto cops do not stop whipping heads. There would be riots during the coming summer, and his network would be there experiencing their baptism of fire. The whole world will be watching us, and if we can survive even a year, they'll look like fools. And nothing bugs the American white man more than looking like a fool. Well, you know, I don't mind making Whitey look like a fool, Dean said. And you know, I'm with you all the way. But do you really think we got a chance of winning? Who said anything about winning? We don't have to win. What we have to do is get down to the nitty-gritty and force Whitey to choose between the two things he seems to dig more than anything else. Fucking with us and playing Big Daddy to the whole world. Makes sense, Turk. But how are we going to force him to choose? Asked Scott. By tying up so many of his troops here in the States and stretching him so thin economically that he discovers he can't do both at the same time. And don't ever think he's not so hooked on messing with us that he won't do anything to keep the scene the way it's always been. Us on our ass and him dragging it. He could go all the way, barbed wire, concentration camps, gas ovens, a final solution of the Negro problem. He paused to listen to the stereo. Billie Holiday was singing God Bless the Child. Papa may have and Mama may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. Dig that. We got to get our own. But before we can, we got to get that black nigger pride working for us. We put it away like sharecroppers put away their best, most precious things. You know how the people are who come up from the South? Down inside that big trunk with the big lock, wrapped up inside tissue paper and cotton batting, and maybe nowadays in foam rubber and saran wrap, they got at least one thing they brought along from down South. One thing they couldn't leave behind, that they cherish above all else. It's too precious to even take out every now and then to look at and feel, but they know it's there. Well, that nigger pride is like that. We wrapped it up and put it away inside that trunk, inside a cedar chest, wrapped up in paper and cotton balls, mothballs, with a big lock on the outside, waiting for a day when we'd need it. We got to get inside that trunk and get out, or find out if it's empty. White folks been trying to rob that trunk for centuries, and maybe they did, and we didn't know it, or it shriveled up and disappeared out of disuse. But if we can find it and use it, if we can get that black pride going for us, then nothing is going to stop us until we're free. Nothing and nobody. They'll have to kill us or free us. 25 million of us. It's going on long enough. Now's the time to say, no more, baby. It stops right here. They got very short memories about what they've been doing to us since slavery. And if you don't believe we've had it made from the first time they brought us over crammed into those boats, ask Whitey. Remember all those plantation movies? You can see them every night on television nowadays. Stud Davis straightened, tilted an imaginary planter's hat to the correct angle on his head, puffed on a long imaginary cheroot. Boy, I say there, boy, Davis said, waving expansively toward the seated cobras, speaking in a parody of the southern cultured drawl of the Hollywood bourbon aristocrat. Scott, The comedian of the three took his cue and, leaping to his feet, approached Stud in a sideways shuffle.
"Now, who that? Say who that? When I say who that, why, Lordy, if it ain't Mr. Bogart come home from the war. Bless me, it's George, my faithful old slave retainer. But George," said Bogart Davis, choking with emotion, "you're free now. You're not a slave anymore." "Free? That bad, massa? I gwine need a doctor?" "No, George. It means you're not my slave anymore. You can leave the plantation. Go anywhere you wish."
"But I don't want to leave, Mr. Bogart."
"But I can't pay you, George. The carpetbaggers have ruined me."
"Well, now don't you worry none about paying me. Why, I wouldn't rightly know what to do with money. I just want to stay right here with you, Mr. Bogart."
He turned and shuffled off. The others were weak with laughter. You don't think it wasn't like that? Read your history books. But somewhere, we scared them. Think about it. Everyone they tried to work those fields in the hot sun dropped like flies, and then they started bringing us over from Africa. It didn't matter how many of us died as long as we lasted through a crop, because they figured on an endless supply. We down on that big plantation when they first start bringing the slaves over, the one in all the movies with the happy niggers who never want to be free. They bring in those niggers from Charleston or Savannah, first nigger slaves to be worked in that area. Cat owns the plantation is progressive, see? So he's conducting this southern scientific agricultural experiment. They were all standing now as if on the street corner talking trash. The commedia dell'arte of the ghetto. "Yeah, man," said Stud. "MGM in Technicolor. Big ass house. Looked like the White House. Big porch on the front. Big white pillars." "Yeah," said Scott. "Barefoot darky sitting on the steps plucking a banjo."
"And singing a spiritual," said Dean. "Never no blues in the movies. White folks scared of that. But a spiritual talking about how good it going to be when they dead, they got a big magnolia tree in the yard. And big ass double doors about 20 feet high, and inside in the hall a big chandelier and a winding staircase. Nah, man, a big curved double staircase. And downstairs," said Freeman, "Massa Charlie waiting for his wife dressed in white. Smoking a cigar this long and this skinny, black string tie and a long coat with a center vent up to here. Yeah, cat with the side vents and long sideburns is the bad guy, and maybe he got on a fancy vest, yellow silk. Then the chick standing up there on top of the stairs, she a blonde or maybe a redhead. The chick with black hair is the bitch who digs the cat and gets somebody to waste him, but she changes her mind and jumps in front of the good guy and gets burned instead. Yeah, the good chick ain't never got black hair. She got one of them little umbrellas with the ruffles. They call them parasols. Yeah, little ass parasol and a floppy hat with a big ribbon down to her ass. Wide skirt and she all pink, maybe. Pink dress, pink parasol, pink cheeks, pretty little pink toe chick. She come down the staircase like she floating. And the head nigger hand the cat his big brim hat. Yeah, nigger think he into something. Don't never smile, but his handkerchief head old lady always sassing the white folks, and the head nigger don't dig it." "Groovy," said Freeman. "You got the picture. They go out into the yard, and the carriage is there. Two horses. Not black. That's for the bad cat. Brown. The carriage is real shiny with red or yellow spokes on the wheels. nigger with a straw hat in his hand holding the horses. They going out into the cotton fields to see how many niggers died since the sun come up. You know, property inventory. They get out into the technicolor fields and the niggers ain't dead. They singing, baby. Singing and laughing, and them white folks don't know if they laughing at them, said Freeman. You think them white folks weren't scared? You think that didn't flip them out? Out there in them fields where everybody else been dropping like flies, niggers singing and swinging. You think they didn't want to stop that song? That they still don't have to stop that song? Well, baby, we're gonna sing and nobody's going to shut us up. We're going to sing a freedom song loud enough for the whole world to hear. We're going to open up that trunk and get out that black pride. He was silent, lost in his thoughts. They watched him cross the room and mix a drink. You cats don't listen to spirituals anymore. They taught you to be ashamed, but the message is there. Go down, Moses, and set my people free. What people you think they were talking about? Man, it's all there if you listen. You can't find your history in the white man's books. If you want to know your history, listen to your music. Remember that Spade poetry I read you last week? He recited. Why do we wait so long on the marble steps, blood falling from our open wounds? And why do our black faces search the empty sky? Is there something we have forgotten? Something we have lost wandering in strange lands? Freeman paused and looked at them. Yeah, we lost something. We lost our freedom. And we forgot something, too. We forgot how to fight. He looked at each of them in turn. Waste the Comanches. The Comanches? What do you mean, Turk? Asked Dean. I've been holding you back too long. It's time to find out what you can do. You've been complaining about the Comanches, saying you don't have balls anymore. Invading your turf, messing with your chicks, calling you junkies and punks. You don't do something, the fuzz got to get suspicious. No way you could get that tame so fast. Stud, you set it up. You ain't supposed to be on nothing except some heavy pot anyway, so it will figure to be your scene. Put out the word you want to rumble. Daddy will supervise. Stud's field commander. Insist on no heats, just fists if you can get it, but that's not so important. Try not to kill anybody if you can help it, and don't forget what I taught you. Okay, split. I got to get ready for a date. They filed out of his apartment, excited and already discussing plans for the fight.
Context of white supremacy. We are kind of towards the end of chapter 10, like a page or two, and then we'll move to chapter 11. Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone to join in the discussion, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.cc/1race. and that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in the address, look on the left of the page, click the link that says free vote line. Once you do that, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you are comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. And you should be able to hear the broadcast live. It is the same procedure if you'd like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6 when you do so. You will hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. Do that. I'll see your hand on the screen, and we will get you on a line. If folks have commentary they would like to share, feel free. Please do not wait till the last minute. Everyone who dialed in who has a hand up should be with us.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I am grateful. I'm very grateful for the COWS program. And that's all I want to say for now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you, sir. Other folks who had commentary that they wanted to share, feel free. No one had commentary from the first audio segment. Nothing stood out specifically.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was just lost my place. Just give me a second. I was just looking up what I highlighted. Yes, this reading is actually very, very, very good. On page 100, he actually wrote a section that I found to be very, just very well done. He writes, you really dig spades, don't you, Turk? Yeah, I feel about spades the way you feel about the Cobras. They're my family. I got a family of about 25 million people. He smiled. Ain't no way I can ever be lonely. But he was lonely. His copper, his plans had forced him into himself, and his loneliness ate at him like a cancer. Always the iron control. Even when drunk, the cover, everything, himself, nothing. Afraid even when he cried out in orgasm that he might give something away. Only with the Cobras he could be open, but he knew he used them as well. Sometimes he looked at their faces, trying to etch their features into his memory, knowing that many, if not all of them, would not survive, knowing also that they had no future otherwise. The endless waiting in the lines, unemployment lines with sullen blank black faces at their end, the white man boss in his office, memoranda on his desk to get tougher, cut down the unemployment rolls, force them out into the streets and into the other lines leading them to employment offices where there were jobs only for white faces. Junk jail or junk in jail and more junk available for those with the price in the county jail. The guards, the safest pushers in the city. They can't bust you in the slam. The junkies joke between heroin nods. An aborted marriage to a favorite fuck and a favorite black baby with no hope and no future in the land of milk and honey, replete with goodies in white plastic cases for God's own children with white plastic faces. I found that section to be just incredible. The way that he looked at at that time, 25 million black people in this country, And he looked at them as family. And the way that he projected that, even though he understood that he had to actually become someone completely different as far as not showing his deepest self in order to facilitate the end game, which was to replace white supremacy with justice. And the understanding that even though not all black people might be a part of his group, which now he's setting up the cells across the country, but there's one thing about revolution that even for those people who choose not to get involved, especially in the beginning stages when everything is first taking off, as the understanding of the reality of what's taking place starts to take hold on other people, it can turn into a tidal wave of people. And I remember there's a great African proverb that says the ants will always topple the elephant, which basically speaks to the fact that the elephant is just one big object, and there's millions and millions of ants that can topple that one giant, seemingly insurmountable object. And that is essentially what white supremacy is, and that is essentially the role we have to play. And it's interesting that he took that approach and his understanding of the fact that if they did not fight for liberation, that all that was left for them was destruction in the form of drugs, unemployment, and all the other things that have ruined our lives as black people in this country. So I found that to be just very, very important. On page 103, Mr. Greenlee writes, they gradually built up a network of safe houses, arms caches, and message drops. Only Freeman knew the entire network. The rest were divided between Dean Scott and Davis. He tried to figure a way for training with handguns, then dismissed the idea as one which would attract too much attention. Besides, the kind of fighting he had in mind would find that kind of weapon almost useless. And this was just brilliant because it just takes me to the art of war and the fact that you don't give all of your information regarding your plans to everyone. You know, you tell specific people what they need to know to accomplish the specific mission, and very few people know the entire plan. So if one person gets caught, your entire plan is not lost. Then the whole idea of teaching them to be able to withstand torture, and the fact that, like you said, you have to give them a certain amount of time to get their fun, as far as their fun in torturing you, out of their system and make them believe that they've done enough to you to the point where they brutalize you, that you'll tell them whatever they want to hear. And in reality, you're telling them not necessarily the truth. You're telling them what they need to hear to get them off of you and allow your comrades to be able to complete the mission, which is replacing white supremacy with justice. I think all of this is just very important. And this is this section of the book really brought me into a mind state of just loving this book in the way that Mr. Greenlee formulated it, simply for that reason. And then when he starts chapter 10, he writes, they won't come looking for you because junkies don't do what we're going to do. And starting very soon, the King Cobras is going to be the most turned on gang in Chicago. So there it is. He's now facilitating a cover, and that cover falls in line with the way white supremacy functions. So white people will just look at them as, you know, be another gangster out on drugs, and they can just do the things they only do in their minds, which is just, you know, continue to terrorize, brutalize. And he had the ideology that if they were strung out on drugs, they would be in a situation where the police would be more apt to abuse them, but less apt to maybe kill them, simply because they're addicts and they're less of a threat in the mind of the police. So I just found that to be just a brilliant forethought and understanding of how white people function and their belief that they're so superior in a system of white supremacy, which they are, but in a way in which they have no idea that the people who they've been brutalizing have something for them that's coming down the road, but then just too blind due to their racism to even see what's coming. So these are all things that kind of set up what's to come down the road, and I find that just brilliant. On page 106, he writes, the gang organization was perfect for this purpose. The Cobras had already been an underground organization, visible only in their moments of violence, closed off to the outside world otherwise. Freeman built on the original organizational structure, following the same chain of command, utilizing the already rigid discipline, and introducing refinements borrowed from the French Marquis, the Israeli, Cyprio, and Yugoslav underground movements. The training proceeded more rapidly than he had anticipated, since for the first time in most of their lives, the members of the King Cobras had educational motivation. And I just find that just beautiful, because with black children, because we get such inadequate and just horrifically racist education, these things drive our children to not have any interest in learning, simply because they're learning white supremacy, and they're learning it in the worst way, in the worst form, which is from your enemy, which is the white female in the first place. And then on top of that, she's basically further teaching you that they're superior to you. Whereas when you give black children an understanding of who and what they are, and you give them a goal, and that goal is something as beautiful as the concept of liberation in the form of replacing white supremacy with justice, once they get that educational understanding of what the reality is and what the solution is, they will be motivated to get things done. It's no different than just listening to Justice at 10 years old, understanding what it means to be white, and approaching her understanding of what it means to be white the way that she did. She was just brilliant. So I can't imagine what she's like now as a young lady about to go off to college if she hasn't gone already. Just that understanding of reality, it just breeds a motivation to want to make something better than what it is and better than what's in front of your face. And I think that's something we can look at and utilize with our children, just to teach them what racism is, how it works, and what it means to be white, and essentially teach them these things as young as possible so we can facilitate their ability to protect themselves as best they can and navigate the system in a way that's conducive to their survival. I'll stop there. There's a couple of other things I wanted to say as well, but I'll just give other people a chance to speak. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi. This is a female caller from New York. I have been following along with the archives, and I got a chance to listen to some of the reading in this segment. But two things stood out to me. The first one is something that I saw in the movie, that exchange where you had the the two members that Mr. Greeley was doctrinating play out the slave narrative. In the movie, the person who was the master was the very, very light-skinned passing indoctrinate, while the person who was playing the I'm the slave, you freed me, what am I going to do with money, was a black person, was a highly melanated dark person. So that kind of stood out to me. That whole character stood out to me. And I think that Mr. Greeley made a wonderful analogy and characterization in showing us the different hues of black people and the roles and the functions that can play even within this so-called revolutionary scene in this revolutionary story. The other thing that stood out to me was the color pink. When you decode white women and their role in the system of racism, white supremacy, one of the things that stands out is the things that are associated with them that are normally indoctrinated into young girls. And one of them is the color pink. Something about that color and the way that they use it in the system really should get our attention, but it doesn't, because like everything else, they normalize it. The color pink is not even a real color. Okay, it's not in the spectrum of colors. It's actually the color red that is whited down. Okay, but white women use it as a, it's associated with white women, as you heard in the book when they talked about the white woman's clothing, and this was pink and it was frilly and this and that. And of course, when we have children, we associate the colors that they tell us to associate with them. And I don't think we even give that any thought. If it's a girl, it's pink, because that is part of the indoctrination into the female aspect and system, in the system of white supremacy. Another thing about the color pink is that I'm trying to put this as concise as possible. With all things, they take things and they, things that are part of nature and natural, especially within the black body, and they water it down. Red is a color that is actually a power center that's inside of us. So in that, I think that consciously, I really believe this is consciously, when they watered red down and made it pink, it was also a symbol of power for white women. So I just wanted to bring that out, and I think people really, we as black people should really give that a lot of thought when we see how they use the color pink, even in movies and even in advertisements, and how they associated with their women. So that's all I wanted to bring out. I'll mute my line.
Huh. Interesting. I'll have to ponder on that one. Was there anybody else that had commentary we haven't heard from? Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Good evening. Yeah, I have to ponder on that one too, man. I was sitting there like, wow, I never thought of that. And having twins, you know, everything was pink for the girl and everything was blue for the boy. And it was, wasn't hard blue, it was a soft, like, baby blue, I guess they call it, but just very interesting. Man. Yeah, I thought that Ross pretty much laid it out. what the lady said about the guy in the movie, because that threw me off too. I didn't see this movie until one day I met Roz and he told me, oh, just YouTube it, it's on there. And I did it and I saw the movie and I was very pleased with it. But that very unmelanated person really threw me off for the whole movie, and I just didn't see him as a black person. But, you know, I mean, like she said, you know, I think he was trying to show all the different spectrums of hue he come in. And I thought he did look sort of like a Puerto Rican. And essentially, you know, they are black too. So I guess, you know, if he was being just showing the whole spectrum. And I think she cleared that up for me, because I always had that problem with that. As far as the book goes, yeah, this is very, I wasn't able to read. I was in transit while I was listening. But this was a very, you know, poignant section on how he got into the psyche of the young black man. And he kind of approached it, in my way, in my opinion, the same way the gangs approach it. You know, had to have that guy that people's going to look up to, you know, and, you know, it's the big shot, and, you know, get into their ears and get into their heads and make them believe in something, but he has them believing in something that's, you know, that is tangible, you know, not being, you know, in charge of a block you don't own, you know. I mean, you know, he has them believing in freedom and revolution, evolution, you know, evolving into being something other than street thugs. And the cover of the drugs, you know, this is the first time I'm reading this book, you know, so the cover of the drugs, you know, I thought was brilliant. Just knowing the psyche of white people, I think Ross kind of touched on it, white cops thinking these aren't but a bunch of junkies, you know, we could just pull over and make fun of them, you know, but we're really not going to, you know, go all out because, you know, they're not, we want these niggas going, so they're just killing themselves slow, you know. And I just think it's a brilliant idea. I'm not sure if it would work in real life, but it's a brilliant idea. And 1960s, I could definitely see why. Black Panthers on the street the gang element was pretty prevalent in both Chicago and New York in the 70s. I mean, in L.A. as well. So it would have been something that could have came to fluidity, you know. I just think that, you know, he did a great job at how he's laying this out in the book. It's well written, and someone's doing a great job commentating it. Are you reading the book right now, Gus, or did you tape yourself reading it?
This is a recording.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, man, Gus, it's like you stop and your voice is strong again. I'm like, wow, man, Gus is like a rapper or something. You know, you got that breath control. Like you run around the track with a mic, you know, practicing to get on stage. But brilliant book. I don't really have too much more to say because all my points are hit, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. Other folks have commentary. Please don't wait till the last minute. Feel free to chime in, have a hand up. Some of the quick things that I also noted as we were going through the text. The first kind of scene where Freeman is with the other white do-gooder, social worker racists, and he seems very skilled at being able to trick these whites by flattering them and including their literature in his presentation, like, I got these ideas from you, and, you know, this is exactly what you wrote in The Atlantic, and your post about, you know, firearms training and blah, 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 just so that the whites think, oh, okay, this nigger is just doing what we want. And I think his understanding of racism, that even the whites who allege to be well-meaning and we just want to help the niggers, where he says they want their choice to have been an act of charity. This is on page 90. An act of charity for a Negro not quite up to the job. They want me to fumble, stumble, turn to them for help. They would like the Washington Freeman when he was still at the CIA. He was a good boy. Part of them wants me to vindicate their choice of a spade for the position, but another part wants me to prove once again that it is spade incompetence, not white racism, which was responsible for the scene. They'll use me, but they'll never like me, where he seems to have a very accurate understanding of these whites, even the ones who come out and act like, yes, we're trying to do all this and getting all this money and making great careers and publishing reports about how much we are doing to help the little niggers in Chicago. And I think a lot of times we get fooled by these whites. Not all of us, but I do think some of us get fooled by whites like this. Even reminded me of Gus at times in talking to these whites on the program and being able to cite some of their work and some of the ways that you can diffuse their racist animosity for a moment if you have your own plan, your own agenda for what you're trying to accomplish in being in contact with them. Moving forward, let's see. The portion where he moves and now he's having this conversation with some of the members of the Cobras. And he says, when he asks him, he says, you ever think there might not be any Cobras? And Dean is kind of surprised and saying that he never thought about it. And just it seemed like he didn't really know how to respond. And Freeman comes back and he says, well, it's something that you should think about because all of us could die. And I do think that that is important, particularly it even reminding me of when people were talking about the situations this summer, the shootings of the enforcement officials in Louisiana and Dallas, and people not really taking it seriously and kind of cheering and saying, yeah, right on, that's wonderful, like this is, you know, a video game or like we're watching The Godfather or something, and not really taking it seriously that people dying is something that should be taken very seriously. Any form of death, and particularly when in a system of racism, white supremacy, that retaliation could come in the form of not one or two black people dying, but large numbers of black people dying, which has been the case repeatedly throughout the system of racism, white supremacy, and just really taking it serious. Any black person being involved with counter-racism, even if you're just talking, I mean, they're talking about counter-violence, but even just verbalizing thoughts on racism, white supremacy could result in you dying and taking that seriously, that not just you could die, but all the people that you're involved with, family, friends, it could happen to them as well, because that has been done repeatedly throughout the history of white terrorism. I just thought that was really important
having kind of one of those moments, you know, about let's be serious about this, thinking that, you know, this could end up with you dying, and having that in the forefront of your mind while we are going through all this training and getting ready to do all of this. That soon after that comes the scene, I think, that Roz eloquently touched on, about him talking about how he has 25 million friends and the way that he looks at all of black people. The portion, I thought it was pretty interesting, particularly given the commentary that some folks have shared about black people not joining the enforcement officers, the police, or not joining the army, the military. Even that was part of the Black Panther 10-point program, having black people be exempt from the armed services because of racism, where he says the exact opposite. No, this is our postgraduate course. This is the best ground training that we could have to teach us skills that we don't have, and they could do it in a much more efficient manner, and that you can be specific about the type of training that you want to help us further our efforts, and that all of the black Vietnam veterans are keys, that we could get them and they could help teach us, reminding me of the late Geronimo Pratt, who fit exactly what he was talking about, who did, I believe, two tours in Vietnam and came back and transferred a lot of his expertise to the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It even saved quite a few black people's lives. I think one of the forms of punishment that he would mete out would be to have black people fill sandbags to fortify some of the Black Panther headquarters. And so when enforcement officials would come and have these gun battles and shoot into Panther facilities, though them having these sandbags in some of the facilities, it literally saved some black people's lives. But I thought that was a really important passage as well. The portion also where he calls out specifically and saying that this is beyond just hating white folks, reminded me of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. I think she has stated that repeatedly on the program about counter-racism being beyond just hating white people, and really that not being something that is going to be able to sustain you in working against racism, white supremacy, just if you, you know, have some sort of burning hatred of whites. And I would say I completely agree with that. Just it's been my experience, regardless of how angry you are about any particular situation, any particular incident, regardless of how angry you are at racists, it's very, very hard for that emotion to be long lasting. It tends to wane. It's very hard to stay angry day in, day out, all day long, just to be fuming. And it's not healthy. That's the sort of thing that is going to wear you down if you're just moving with that anger every single day. Not that we are not justified in being upset about what racists have done, continue to do to us. Also thought it was quite interesting. I think Thomas and some of the other callers touched on his part of their ploy so that they are not being recognized by enforcement officials as potential threats, to act as though you are still under the influence of drugs. I know in the movie, they don't even go towards pot. They go towards heroin and saying, you know, make it look like you still got arms, tracks in your arm from where you have been shooting up, which certainly was a major part of racism, white supremacy in the 70s. That goes right to the book that we talked about earlier this year, Drugs as a Weapon Against Us, with John Patash. You had lots of black people, 60s, 70s, who were riled up and working against racism, white supremacy. One of the responses, start flooding lots of hard drugs into areas with black people and fusing that with protests about racism. Heroin, Vietnam was a part of that as well. I think they call it the Golden Triangle. Using that, since you've got all of this traffic and supplies and ammunitions going into that area for Vietnam, that we can also be harvesting and bringing back lots of heroin at that time, and getting lots of black people hooked on heroin at that time, both black Vietnam veterans as well as black activists at that time. But also with the drug thing, where he continues and he says, as the Cobras, as they got more codified, as they learned more and they got more motivated to learn, they even lost interest in pot. I won't say anything on that other than that is interesting, particularly given all of the commentary we've heard about legalizing cannabis and how great that would be about racism. Maybe if we got a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, we would lose interest in cannabis altogether. Continuing, Let's see. That's most of the stuff I have for chapter 9. Moving into chapter 10. Let's see. Where he says, how long before he's, this is Freeman talking, he says, would it be finally, he wondered how long this would last, how long before he began believing each word as if the word of God. Would it be when he finally had the power of life and death, when the resources of the city and perhaps the nation were devoted to finding, when the resources of the city and perhaps the nation were devoted to finding and destroying him, how long before he saw himself as a black messiah? And he kind of rebukes that, where he's telling them that we have no, you know, head black people in charge. I think that's really, really important. Him talking about how throughout history, whenever you have black people trying to organize against racism, white supremacy, they just go kill the leader, whether it's Dr. King, Minister Malcolm, Patrice Lumumba, if you want to go global about it, just go kill whoever we think the leaders are, Fred Hampton with the Black Panther Party. If we can kill or jail or somehow neutralize whoever the head black people are, then that will destroy everything. And I think that is why Mr. Fuller talks about having open air counter racist codification, and each person being an individual leader, each person being an individual army of one, and not looking for another black person to be a leader. I think that is why he emphasizes that so much. Follow logic, not following an individual person. And it sounds like Dan Freeman is saying exactly that to his young cadre of counter racists in Chicago. Also, let's see. Reminded me so much of today when he says that they were going to operate under the cover of the ensuing riots that he knew were going to take place. He says he knew as surely as the sun rises that cops who occupied the ghetto would not give up their pastime of whipping niggers' heads in spite of directions from above concerning less physical means of arrest and investigation in the ghetto. I would say that you could slide that into commentary right now, 2016, regardless of body cams or how many protests or anything else. These beatings, these shootings, enforcement officials killing, terrorizing black people worldwide is not going to stop as long as the system of white supremacy exists. This is just a mandatory aspect of the system. I was going to ask about the portion on nigger pride, but I think Mr. Scotty Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network, is with us as well. Thank you for joining us, sir. Did you have commentary you wanted to get in also?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. I love this. It's my all-time favorite film. Never read the book, so I appreciate all the book studies sessions that you do on Fridays. Wanted to comment on the military portion of it. Lots of the Black Panther Party members were drafted into Vietnam. And that is where, you know, they got their military skills from, is actually out there on the battlefield. And so I think, though, I don't see a contradiction in their 10-point plan in barring people, black people, from military service when you consider that at that time they had a military draft. My father was drafted. He wasn't drafted. He actually volunteered so they wouldn't take his little brother. They drafted my uncle, which was his youngest brother, and they allowed him to go in his place. And so he was drafted. So a lot of black men were being taken out of the family, never to be returned, sent to go fight for white supremacy against harming of the non-white people. And so also that's another reason why the Panthers took that, put that in their 10-point program. Now, I do understand both sides of it and what have you. I went into the military, as you know, and I'm deploying what I learned in there, and part of what I learned in there in the implementation of Black Talk Radio Network. So, but if I had read his book or read Malcolm X's biography at 18, I would probably made a different choice and found another way to get college money. So I just wanted to say I don't think that there's any contradiction there. And also that about our military prowess as well as fighting men. The listener had attended the African American Museum that just opened in Washington, D.C., and he has heard me ask the question, well, where are they going to start Black people's history? And it, are they going to talk, take it back to the Revolutionary War, where one third of the Continental Army was Black people, free and enslaved Africans? And that the Continental Army had lost the first, it was 9 battles in the Revolutionary War. The Continental Army lost the first 6 until George Washington lifted the race that they had on Blacks participating. And then they won the final 3, which were decisive. And so Black guns mattered. And I was pleased to hear that they do start there and cover that history at that African-American Museum. And he said they cover all the wars that we have participated. And he said that Black guns have mattered in terms of America dominating the globe. Without us, they would have lost the so-called, where you had to fight between white supremacists, the white supremacists of the North and the South. And the North only won because Black people, again, Black guns matter. So I don't want to play down the importance or the value of military training, but if you're going to go in there, know exactly what you're doing, know exactly what you're doing. And I'll mute my line, but again, thank you for this book.
For sure, Mr. Reed, for sure. Appreciate the commentary. Did anybody, I was going to ask if folks had any thoughts, his commentary about the significance, the importance of Black nigger pride. That reminded me of Dr. Welsing again and Black self-respect that she talked about so frequently. But any folks have thoughts on that or anything else they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yes, I do. In reference to the Black nigger pride, what I think about is the fact that the brilliance of Dr. Welsing was not only the fact that she, and I believe Scotty said this before, you cannot say that her theory of genetic annihilation is a theory. It has been proven without question. But the other aspect is the fact that the linchpin in their dominating and controlling Black people was the removal of Black self-respect. And that is like just, it's just one of the truest things I'd ever heard when I first came across that whole idea. It just blew my mind because that's exactly what it is. And that Black nigger pride is Black self-respect. That's just Sam Greenlee's eloquent way of putting it as far as using vernacular language. But that's exactly what it is. It's the whole idea of rebuilding the what was brutally taken from our manhood. Literally our balls were castrated, figuratively we've been castrated. And that is, and I love the way he describes it as that gem that's wrapped up in all of these different things and stuffed in this trunk in a place where, and like he said, it's that thing you just can't leave behind when you leave everything you have. That's the one thing that you have to take with you. And it's something that I know that I've seen amongst our people. That is something that we are seeking. That's one of the things that causes, I think, a lot of enmity between us is the fact that, or even if it's not consciously, if it's subconsciously, we're aware that we're missing an important aspect of who we are as African descendant people. And I think that is it. And I believe that that was just one of the most brilliant and eloquently vernacular in vernacular explained and brought about. I figured other people probably want to get some stuff in, but I had a couple other things I was going to touch on. I'll do it later, but I wanted to answer your question. Thank you. And I'll meet my line.
Folks have any other comments on Black nigger pride or anything, any other aspects of the book that stood out? Even the description of that, where he talks about Black people coming from the South, reminded me of one of our other book study selections, Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic Black migration we did a couple years back. But any other comments folks wanted to get in on Black nigger pride or anything else that stood out from the text?
Can I just get in one thing since no one else spoke up yet?
Yes, sir.
And it's in the book. Okay, thank you so much. It's on page 111, where Mr. Greenlee writes, they listened to Miles Davis records and to Lady Day, Prez, Monk, Diz, and the rest, and began hearing things in jazz that they had heard in rhythm and blues. They listened to down-home blues. He became the father and big brother they had never had. Although he fought it, he returned their affection and love. He knew this could be a fatal weakness, but he could not help it. He watched them grow. Now that they had a purpose and found it, and found it sad that there was nothing for them, he had watched them grow now, and now that they had a purpose and found it sad that there was nothing for them in this land where their ancestors had lived for hundreds of years except destruction. But in that negative urge to strike out against oppression, they had found something that freed them from their fears and doubts about themselves and their color. He watched them grow and become more human and knew that their newfound humanity would not inhibit their becoming the killers he was training them to be. And I found this to be just beautiful because earlier in the text, Mr. Greenlee speaks about him using them, and of course using them to the ends of replacing white supremacy with justice. And in this section, I find it even more telling because even though he had a job to do and he took a highly refined military approach to what he was doing, I found it very hard because when you are looking towards liberation, it is something that you do out of love. So even though he had to remain as detached as possible, I think that that is one of the highest forms of the expression of the term love I've ever seen is liberation, especially when it comes to black liberation and the liberation of black people globally. I think that is one of the highest expression of love for oneself or one love for one's people that a person can ever exhibit. And like you said, it can be a fatal weakness in the sense that people might try to use people that you're close to get at you because they figure you are the more important person in the group to take out. But the idea is that that kind of love is something that I think over time that you cannot hide. So even when we're teaching children, even if these are children that we're not related to per se, we watch them grow and watch them become more whole young black people. It's all your purpose for doing it is out of love in the first place. And then that love tends to grow quite rapidly as you see that other person, that young child or that teenager develop into a more whole black person. And I think that that was just very, very eloquently stated the way that he had written it in the text. And then also beyond the fact that he had that love for them, he also understood that he trained them with such precision in the tactics of military consciousness that he understood that they can actually, turn into the deadliest people he needed them to be at the moment that they needed to be deadly. So I just think that that was just an awesome, awesome paragraph that he had written. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
For sure.
Gus, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just one last thing to anybody that's in the military that's listening. And a shout out to the North Carolina National Guard that was called out to keep, I like the way you said it, Gus, them Negroes in line. You did not see a Ferguson in Charlotte. You did not see the National Guard pointing their guns. I didn't see any of them with any weapons. And that they acted like that they were the relatives of the people in Charlotte. And I saw a few black faces in the National Guard, and I appreciate your conduct. And but anyway, to the people that's in the military, things are getting bad in the world. You may have to make a choice. And that choice is, do I follow these immoral orders or not? I'm going to just put the question I put to myself when the L.A. rebellions was going on after Rodney King. And I asked myself, now, if they deployed me, I'm regular Army, so that's not going to happen. They're going to call out the National Guard. But if they did, and this white man gave me an order, they gave us live rounds and gave me an order to shoot to kill, would I shoot other black people, other quote-unquote American citizens? So things are getting bad, and it could get to that point to where you're going to have to ask yourself that question. Or am I going to turn the gun on the one who gave me the immoral order? Thank you.
appreciate that. Appreciate that. I think that is going to pop up later in the text once things get rolling. Pretty much around the same issue that happened in Charlotte last week. But that is, this book is not that long either. We are more than halfway done. So we have at most three sessions left, might only be two, but it is not that long. That's why I always say it's nice to have fiction. Normally we don't do fiction for our book study, but nice to pick up some fiction every now and then. And this one, certainly with racism at the core, you can use fiction to explain a lot of truths about white supremacy. I also thought it was significant when they do their whole mocking of these plantation flicks. I think I have stated consistently, we do not have a shortage of black bondage flicks. There are lots of them, and it seems like they have seen enough of them that they already know how these flicks have looked. And even though now you have more films where it's not the same stereotypical presentation that is being joked about in Mr. Greenlee's work, the core of it, blacks being brutalized and raped and whipped and in shackles and all of that, the core of it is pretty much the same. Maybe you have, you know, one or two more of the niggers, they get to hit a white person or something like that in the film. But I mean, Django Unchained is kind of close to what they are mocking here in the text. I did think that was significant as well. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we get to audio segment number two? Everybody satisfied? Nothing else in particular stood out? I was going to ask female caller in New York, did you have something else you wanted to make sure you got in?
Oh, yes. Thank you. I'm sorry. I keep getting knocked out. About that black nigger pride, and you mentioned Dr. Welving. So I think, I don't know if it was Roz, and you mentioned Dr. Welving. That, in my opinion, is the key ingredient that she was speaking of needed to help us to solve this problem in every area of people, activity, even in the areas of, you know, religion and sex and all of the other activities. In my opinion, that's what she was speaking of when she said black self-respect. It was that kind of pride that we saw in our communities. I'm thinking about Tulsa, Oklahoma, and all of the other thriving businesses that we had. Now, there was no shortage of white terrorism. Don't get it twisted. But that element, that black nigger pride, that organized black nigger pride, I think that we should throw that word in, especially when we're talking about this book and what Mr. Greenlee's concept was. That organized black nigger pride was allowed us to at least support ourselves in every area, even in religion. Thinking about that black nigger pride, is what allowed us to keep our indigenous religions, even though we were in a foreign land. We had enough black nigger pride to know how to turn that into something to make white people think that we were worshiping their gods. I'm speaking about Catholicism. So that is something that's very, very important. I think that that was something that Mr. Greenlee got creative with and also threw in there to have, give us something to think about. And I'm sorry, I just have to go back to the color pink. If we think about Victoria's Secret, they have an ad campaign called Pink, which has been their ad campaign for years. I don't see it going anywhere. And it celebrates white female whoredom. That's what it celebrates. So we have to think about that color pink again. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Yep, I was thinking about that. That has been the slogan, Love Pink, on the shirts and bags when you mentioned that color in the context of white supremacy during your first commentary this evening.
Can I help?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think white people have made a concerted effort over the years at picking out black people that have black nigger pride and making examples out of them.
So it's definitely something that's to it, that they going after those who've had it so hard. And I wish we all had it. A new trend with the color pink is they put it on grown men and they got it. It's not yet, but I know it's coming up in the NFL where grown black men are going to be running around the field with pink sneakers and pink parts on their jerseys and pink do-rags. And, you know, even up here in Harlem, you know, where they had at one point that was the color of the Bloods. They went from red to pink. And it was like the cool thing. And I've noticed they've associated pink now with little girls and black men.
I think Mr. Fuller, in one of his shows, alluded to what you were talking about. He said he didn't put it in such a concise and manner. It was something about what you're speaking of, Thomas, as being the new black vagina. If I'm not mistaken, he was breaking down the gender confusion issue.
Right. He's been talking about that for a minute. Emasculating it. I think even that came up in the book, not this week, but last week, where Dan Freeman, when he was having his conversation with Joy about him not wanting to just be a lawyer and try to make as much money as you can, that what you're going to have to do to make that money, you're going to have to hand over your black balls. And he said that regardless of whatever happens, having to live with that and your partner seeing you having been emasculated, that she's going to be disgusted with you, as well as the black people, literally, figuratively, the emasculation of black males and taking of black nigger pride that continues in a variety of ways in the system of racism, white supremacy. We will get to audio segment number two. That way we'll have time if folks have additional commentary, either about things that happened in the first segment or if you have commentary from the second piece of the reading we're about to do. We are right at the closing part of chapter 10. It's just like three pages left, and then we'll be moving to chapter 11. So right kind of at the end of chapter 10, it would depend on which version of the book you have as to where page number we are in the book. It should be around 117-ish or so, somewhere right in there. Context of white supremacy, Sam Greenlee, the spook who sat by the door, audio segment number two.
The Cobras and the Comanches met in a vacant lot flanking the elevated railroad tracks of the Santa Fe Railroad. The fight lasted less than 20 minutes. There were less than 10 Comanches still standing, willing and able to fight, by the time Stud recalled his fighters with a single shrill whistle of command. Stud reported to Freeman the following day. "Was as easy as eating soul food, Turk. We wasted the cats so quick they still trying to figure out what happened. But I didn't get no kicks just running things. Daddy, better for that kind of scene." "You just bugged, Stud, because you couldn't get with it. You'll have plenty of fighting pretty soon. Right now, cool it. Anybody hurt?" "Nah, we cooled it, like you said. Pretty Willie didn't let a cat loose soon enough and think he broke his arm. Heard it crack. Man, that judo shit you teach us as good as a blade. Pretty Willie, huh? Yeah, you know how he can get when he in a fight. He the baddest cat in the Cobras, except for me. When he really mean, you got to kill him to stop him. You know, I think the reason he's so evil, because he's so light. I really think that cat want to be as black as you can get. Always got the blackest chick he can find. Won't look at a light-skinned chick. Before he joined the gang and we started riding him about being so light, you couldn't even talk about his color without a fight. He better now, but he's still hung up. Okay, Stud, cool it. Tell the cats I said they did a good job." Freeman turned and walked down the street, thinking about Pretty Willie Dubois. Pretty Willie was a problem Freeman had to solve because he was potentially one of the leaders of the underground, one who might be trusted to command an underground unit in another city himself. The gang had helped in bringing it right down front. Teasing him about the color of his skin, joking that he thought himself better than the rest because he was so pretty. If Freeman could find some way to get him over that psychological hurdle, Willie would be a field officer as valuable as Stud Davis. He had to find the key. Pretty Willie had improved, as had all of the members of the gang recruited into Freeman's underground, but there was still too much of the brooding about his lack of pigment to trust him to lead others. Freeman saw him as a potential leader of his top cell, his elite guard commander, second in command to Stud Davis. Sugar Hips was an undeveloped natural mathematician, a genius with figures. In any except a ghetto school, his genius would have been recognized and nurtured. In the overcrowded classrooms where the sheer job of maintaining discipline precluded any except the most dedicated of teachers teaching, Sugar Hips Scott was a nuisance. He was far too far ahead of the other students, did his problems too quickly, and was bored with the level of mathematics with which he was forced to deal. He had dropped out of school at 16 in disgust. He went through the geometry, algebra, and calculus text that Freeman got for him from the University of Chicago Library with a speed and alacrity that amused Freeman and awed others of the Cobras. There was not a day when Freeman did not curse the talent and intelligence within the Cobras that had been stifled. And for the simple reason, he thought time and again, that they are black. Scott was his logistics officer, Davis his battle commander, Dean his second in command. Pretty Willie Dubois could be his best fighting commander if he could just find the key to free him from his hang-up about his color. Within a week of the rumble, Freeman thought he had discovered that key. Chapter 11. "We need a propagandist," said Freeman. "I hear Pretty Willie can write." They nodded in agreement. "You want to see him now, Turk?" asked Dean. "Yeah. Where can I find him?" "Probably in his pad in Hyde Park." "I know where it is. I'll see you later." He drove to Willie's pad. It was a basement apartment located in a half-court building. He walked down the short flight of steps and knocked on the door. "Who is it?" "Turk." Willie opened the door. He was barefoot and wearing only a pair of tight gabardine slacks. "Come on in, Turk." Freeman walked into the apartment. There was a long, narrow living room, a small bedroom with kitchen and bath in the rear. A tall redhead with close-cropped hair sat cross-legged on a blanket covered mattress on the floor, smoking a reefer. She had on no clothes. "Go home, bitch," Willie said. Without a word, she arose and walked toward the bedroom. "Wait a minute." She paused. "Turk, you want some of this?" Freeman, looking at the Japanese prints hung on the wall, ignored him. The redhead regarded Freeman woodenly. Willie dismissed her with a wave of his hand. She came from the bedroom shortly after dressing and left. "A fucking freak," Willie said contemptuously. "So what are you doing with her?" "I like to fuck with her white mind." "Looks like you're more shook up than she is." Freeman pointed to the prints. "Nice reproductions. Hokusai? Hiroshige? Udomaro?" Willie pointed to the prints in turn, watching Freeman closely. Freeman walked to a canvas sling chair in the corner and sat. "Daddy tells me you write. Willie's face closed. I'd like to see some of your stuff. It's for the scene. Willie nodded and disappeared into the bedroom. He returned with a large attaché case, unlocked it, and set it at Freeman's feet. He went back into the bedroom while Freeman opened the case and returned wearing a lightweight V-neck pullover. Freeman rummaged through the case. There were the portions of three novels and more than a dozen short stories of varying length. Any poetry? That'll tell me quicker what I want to know. Willie reached into the case, pulled out a manila folder, and handed it to Freeman. He reclined on the mattress on the floor and watched Freeman slightly. We need a propagandist, explained Freeman as he opened the folder. Willie regarded him with more interest. Freeman leafed through several of the poems. He looked up at Willie. You always write in a blues rhythm? Right now, yeah. I've been trying to capture the way the South Side spades talk, but for a long time, it didn't work. Then I figured out they talk the way they sing, so I've been doing a lot of blues things. Most of that stuff I wrote singing. Willie pointed to a guitar case leaning in the corner. When I get an idea, I switch on the tape recorder and mess around with it until it sounds right. Then I play it back, write it down, and rework it on paper. My dialogue is much better than before I started doing that. I can hear those blues rhythms now when I'm hanging out on the block. Funny, I never thought of it that way before. Spades singing when they talk. Whitey says we're nonverbal. Nowadays, they're teaching us English as a foreign language. That's his hang-up. You want some coffee? Willie rose. Long as it's not instant. I don't drink that shit. Come on in the kitchen. Freeman followed him into the kitchen and sat reading the poetry at the kitchen table while Willie busied himself brewing the coffee. He read one poem written as if a Negro on relief were speaking to a white social worker. Anti-poverty blues. He read aloud. I sit here in my soul hole, forgotten, like a can of black caviar on my ghetto grocer's shelf. Freeman nodded, read some of the other poems, glanced through some short stories. Okay, baby, he said. You're the propagandist. Keep the stuff like this, ironic, understated, blues things written for black folks. No shit about white devils. Don't give Whitey any stature by screaming what a big drag he is. Put him down and you build him up. The put on is what we want. Keep the themes simple, few in number, and then work out varieties on those, like in the blues. Use blues rhythms, your poetry, doggerel, anything catchy that people will remember and pass along. We want to plug into the ghetto grapevine. You understand the kind of thing we need? Willie returned to the kitchen table with two mugs of steaming black coffee. Yeah, he said. Yeah, beautiful. I have some ideas already. I can let you see something next week, okay? Groovy. Top security, though. Willie nodded, smiling to himself, thinking things over. Who else would be good at this kind of thing? Freeman asked. Ted, Tandan, and Charlie. Set up your own cell. You're in charge. Let hips know what kind of equipment you need. Mimeo machines, typewriters, paper, ink, office supplies. Keep your operation simple and lightweight. Stuff we can move quickly and easily. Use the two-car garage on Indiana Avenue as your headquarters and scout around for alternative sites in case you have to run. Work out a budget and get the money from hips. Get as much of the stuff hot as you can and buy the rest through a dummy so it can't be traced back to you by the fuzz. You know the routine. We'll need leaflets, handbills, homemade bumper stickers, and scripts for propaganda broadcasts. We'll use cheap transistor tape recorders for that. I want you to work out a complete propaganda program with major themes, priority target groups, and including counter-propaganda for what you anticipate Whitey will say about us once we begin operating. First thing he'll do is cry red. Right, but don't spend too much time denying we're communists. Our people will know better, and we really don't care what whites will think. Also, I want you to work out an international propaganda program for distribution to overseas publications in Europe, Africa, and Asia. They're not likely to get our side from the free white press. How about artwork, cartoons, stuff like that? Excellent. Who do we have? Lots of cats can draw. No trouble there. Songs too? You have the idea. Anything to get our message across. But remember that a lot of this stuff will be done after we've gone underground and are being hunted. The more you can do now, the easier later. I can work up a rough outline of the whole program in about 2 weeks, okay? Take as much time as you need and get in touch whenever you have questions. Willie reached over and turned on the transistor radio, which stood on the kitchen table. It was tuned to the station, beaming its broadcasts to the ghetto. They sat silent a while, listening to Dionne Warwick sing Walk On By. Do most of the Cobras know about your Hyde Park scene, Willie? Sure, they seem to dig I'm living right in the middle of Whitey, particularly since what we've been planning. Daddy and Stud come by all the time, sometimes together, sometimes alone. We lollygag, maybe turn on, or cook up some soul food. We had some red beans and rice last week, was out of sight. He gestured with his hand. This is my cover. My mother wanted me to go to one of those Louisiana excuses for schools where the pecking order is based on the lack of pigment in your skin and the lack of kink in your hair. I cooled her out by enrolling at the university, and she brags about her son being a genius. How much time have you spent in college, Willie? I seldom take a full load of credits. It gets in the way of hanging out with the boys. I guess if you added them up, it would come to a little over 2 years. You intend on getting a degree? What for? What kind of job could I get with it? I hope you're not going to suggest I pass. His face closed again. I don't know what people mean by passing. Being black or white in this country is a state of mind. You're black because you think black, feel black, and act black. I know people who look like charcoal who are more white than whitey, but that's not the point. Whoever told you a university is a vocational school, preparation for a job or career? What else is it? That's what it is for most of the people in this country. But in other places, people feel education has an intrinsic value all its own. In most other countries, an educated man is respected whether he has a crying quarter. Do you know that in Arab countries, people carry a folded newspaper and a pen showing in their pockets as symbols they can read and write? And some Africans will put on their business cards the fact they flunked out of Oxford or Cambridge? The important thing is that they were there. It's not nearly so important that they didn't stay. Black people are going to have to get like that because whites are never going to share the wealth with us. So what's the use of getting an education if you still have to stand in that unemployment line? Because you're a better man for having an education. If we ever break the vicious circle they thrust us into and really get some quality educational institutions in the ghetto, you know what they'll produce? What? The best educated poor people in this country. But it'll be worth it. My grandmother used to say to me, "Get that education, boy. It's the one thing the white man can't take away from you." And she was right. She never asked me what I was going to be. She was just delighted I kept my head in those books. Those books were symbols of freedom to her, and she was right about that too. Willie was thoughtfully silent for a few minutes, moving his crossed foot in time to the music. So, why all the effort if things can't improve? Oh, things can improve, but there will always be two countries here. One white, rich, fat, and smug. The other, black, poor, lean, and striving. It's not such a bad state to be in. There's a whole world out there not getting schizo because they don't keep up with the Joneses. Things can be better without being white. I can't figure you, Turk. What's the figure? What are you? A Muslim? Nationalist? Black power advocate? Or what? Willie, said Freeman, and shook his head sadly. Why do you have to label me? Whitey will do it soon enough when the deal goes down. They will come up with a lot of labels until they find the one which best puts down Uncle Tom, and then all the rest will echo it. Why can't I just be a man who wants to be free, who wants to walk tall and proud on his own turf as a black man? Why can't it be as simple as that? Maybe it's power. If the scene ever gets off the ground, you'll have a lot. Who needs it? You can't eat it, wear it, or screw it. It won't even cure a hangover. How come you're in it, Willie? I want to mess with Whitey. It won't be enough. It's negative. You'll need more positive reason than that to get you through. You ever kill a white man, Willie? No, but I've hurt some pretty bad in fights. It's not the same. When the time comes that you lay a man out with his guts spilled out in the gutter, you'll be surprised how fast hate disappears. He'll be another human being, and you'll have put an end to it. You'll need some love or something to keep you doing that. Unless you find out you enjoy it, and I don't think you will. You better think about that. Some of the cats will enjoy it. Stud will. What do you mean? He's a killer. He doesn't know it yet, but he is. I saw a lot in Korea. Once they get a taste of blood, nothing else gives them as much. Booze, women, nothing. I don't really believe there's any justification for killing, but freedom comes as close as any. Suddenly, Willie realized something. He leaned across the table toward Freeman and placed a hand on his arm. You don't like any of this, do you? Freeman looked into his coffee cup as if searching for his soul. No, he replied. He rose, walked to the sink, and rinsed out his cup. I have to split. They walked to the door. Come by again, Turk. I dug talking to you. Sure, baby. He ruffed Willie's curly hair. And don't worry about not having enough pigment. As far as I'm concerned, you're one of the blackest cats we have. He walked out into the cool evening. He felt he'd got through to Willie, that he'd planted a seed. Willie was involved with the movement now that he had a propaganda program to create. But Freeman would have to bring the color thing down front, get it out into the open once and for all, and either win him or lose him forever. He thought he knew how he could do it. He felt restless and decided to walk most of his rounds that night. He had settled into a routine on the job, cruising or walking the streets, first to judge the mood and atmosphere. Then he would stop in a favorite tavern for a beer before making his checks with his street workers. He walked 63rd Street that night after leaving Willie's apartment and stopped at the Boulevard Lounge. "Hey, Dan, how you doing, baby? Friend of yours back in town," said the bartender. "Hey, man. Friend? Who?" "Pete Dawson. Just got back from California." "Groovy. I've been looking for that cat since I got back to Chicago." He walked the length of the bar and entered a small room in the back, more intimate with less modern and more comfortable furnishings. A small bar was tucked in one corner, and Dawson sat there chatting with the bartender and three customers. "Pete, baby, how you doing, man?" "Freebie, good to see you. I heard you were back in town." They shook hands and punched each other's shoulders, smiling broadly. "Sit down and have a taste. You still drink scotch, don't you?" Dawson ordered drinks. "Pete Dawson, the Sherlock of the South Side. How's the detective business?" "Beats the post office or driving a bus." "What were you doing in California so long?" "I was on detached duty, attending a seminar on riot control. I'm in charge of the plainclothes section of the Riot Control Task Force." "Beautiful, man. You're really coming along. Get a promotion along with it?" "Does it snow in July in Chicago?" Dawson smiled to soften the bitterness in his voice. "No, I'm still a sergeant. I read a paper at the seminar, though, and everyone seemed to dig it. The FBI requested a copy." "What on?" "The Chicago approach to riot control. We think we've combined the best of several plans." "Sounds interesting. Could I take a look at it?" "Sure. Main point is we try to get plainclothes spade cops into the area once it's been sealed off, to try and cool the crowd. We use force only when we have no other choice, and then we don't play around." Freeman thought the paper could be useful, and while thinking it, hesitated. "What kind of cat have I become? I'm going to use a friend, and I don't even blink an eye. Pete, why don't you give us a rundown at board meeting next month? I'm sure the directors will be interested. It'll be good for at least 50 bills. I'll try to get you 100. No sweat with your superior?" "No, he's about as straight as they can get. Gets more bugged than me that I can't get a promotion. Let me know when you want me to come by." "Crazy. You seen any of my street workers?" "Yeah. Tell me they've been working for a change since you took over. I saw Perkins on 63rd Street a few minutes ago. He usually stops in here for a brew about this time." "They had it made before I got here. One cat was in night school and two others were working the night shift at the post office downtown. But that scene is over now. Perkins is a good one, though." "How does it feel to be back in Chicago? Place look different?" "No, looks the same as when we were kids and you were an Apache and I was a Cobra. Good to be home." "Yeah, Chicago gets into your blood." "Yeah, like leukemia." Dawson laughed and switched the pistol on his belt to a more comfortable position. "The Cobras and the Apaches. Man, we had us some rumbles, didn't we?
I still got the scar from that time I got shot. They smiled together, remembering. Ever see any of the cats? Every now and then. Lot of them in the slam in Joliet. I had to bust some. Dawson looked soberly into his glass, drained it, and motioned for another. Man, that's not an easy thing to do. Bust a friend. Freeman tried to change the subject. Think there'll be riot this summer? Ain't there always? We've kept them small so far, but you never can tell. When do you think they might break loose and where? Who can tell? A good time would be when I'm on vacation catching fish in Michigan. You know, they wouldn't do it while you're gone. They're going to give you a chance to be a hero. You know the only spade heroes on this police force are dead. That's what I mean, baby. I'll be there when they make the posthumous citation. Thanks, old buddy. You so good to me. And I'll take care of your little old lady, too, after you've gone. Which one? The one looks like 20 miles of bad road, the only one you got. You know, the chicks always did prefer me to you. Psh, prefer you going the other way. They smiled at one another. Freebie, good to have you back, man. We can really swing together again. Like, really, baby. I better get to work. Cool it, man. He left the bar thinking of how much fun he could have now that Dawson was back in Chicago. He also wondered how to recruit him. And that will do it for this week's session. We'll pick up next Friday on Chapter 12. If you have commentary you would like to share, Mr. Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the number to dial is 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who were with us, first audio segment, should be here. Roz, Thomas in New York, female caller in New York. I'll nab anybody else if you chime in. You have commentary you would like to share. The caller at 5771, you're with us as well. Did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi. The character of Pretty Willie, that is a genius character contradiction. I like the way Mr. Greenlee had perfectly placed that character as a light-skinned black who basically hates the pigment of his skin. And it goes against all of the, current social norms of, you know, the lighter you are, you know, the better looking you are. And, you know, it's funny that, you know, his name, well, it's not funny, but it's like I said, it's genius that his name is Pretty Willie. So it's sort of like, you know, he understands that, you know, he's basically a very rebellious character that goes against, you know, the social norm because of the fact that, you know, he doesn't, you know, it's not like he doesn't think that he's not beautiful, but he understands that he goes against the social norms of, you know, the lighter you are, the prettier you are. And I want to add this too, because in my family's history, we can trace our roots all the way back to where we're from Africa. And my great-great-grandfather, he was considered a mulatto back then. But the thing was that he was very light and hated his light skin because of his father. You know, his father was a slave master who raped my great-great-grandmother. And for years, he would always tell my grandfather and my great-grandfather how much he hated white people because of the fact that he hated his father. And his father would, you know, he always had this question about how white folks would treat you know, their own son. And, you know, he sort of for a while considered him as a son, but, you know, he said he treated the dogs better than him. So, when I was reading along with the character of Pretty Willie, it kind of reminded me of him, you know, how much he hated his own pigmentation. So he's a very interesting character. I just wanted to add that. So I will meet my line.
Appreciate that. Any of the other folks who are on the line with us, your line should be open. Feel free to share any observations.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. First, I wanted to touch on the color pink. I thought that the sister who talked about that, I thought it was brilliant because, like Thomas in New York said, I never thought of it that way. But as I was listening to the building of the conversation between yourself, her and Thomas, it made me think also that when you look at the color pink, it is also an effeminization of masculine energy in the sense that if you study whether it's West Africa, the Yoruba people, or you go back to the Nile Valley, you'll find that the colors red and white were the colors of royalty. The symbol of Heru as a king is red and white as well. So when you see that pink is really just a bleached version of the color red, then it's a form of emasculation. Just the color itself is a form of emasculation of that energy. And then on top of that, if you look at white people, it's also a way of getting us to think of them. Because if you look at white people, they're actually pink. That's the color that they exhibit most regularly is the color pink, whether it's a dirty pink pimple on them or when they're embarrassed or if they're angry, that's their color. So I think when we think of the color pink, too, it also alludes to white flesh or whiteness in a way that's very subconscious and subtle, but it is there. And that's what I wanted to say in reference to that. I just thought the conversation regarding the color pink was brilliant, and I thank her for bringing that out into the discussion. I wanted to touch on page 120, where Mr. Greenlee writes, Sugar Hips was an undeveloped natural mathematician, a genius with figures. In any except a ghetto school, his genius would have been recognized and nurtured. In the overcrowded classrooms where the sheer job of maintaining discipline precluded any except the most dedicated of teachers teaching, Sugar Hips Scott was a nuisance. He was far too far ahead of the other students, did his problems too quickly, and was bored with the level of mathematics with which he was forced to deal. He had dropped out of school at 16 in disgust. He went through the geometry, algebra, and calculus text that Freeman got for him from the University of Chicago Library with the speed and alacrity that amused Freeman and awed others of the Cobras. There was not a day when Freeman did not curse the talent and intelligence within the Cobras that had been stifled for the simple reason, he thought, time and again, that they are black. Scott was his logistics officer, Davis his battle commander, Dean his second-in-command, Pretty Willie Dubois could be his best fighting commander if he could just find the key to free him from his hang-up about his color. Within a week of the rumble, Freeman had discovered the key. Now, I found this very interesting number one, him and his genius with mathematics just reminded me of a situation that happened with my son when he was very young. I remember, I forget the type of math, but he was having trouble with math and he was getting frustrated. And it wasn't something that he normally had trouble with. And I remember I discussed with him the fact that, you know, his people invented math, so there's no way that he should not be good at it. And I actually showed him the proof of the origin of mathematics and numbers with African people. And he ended up taking that information to school. And over time, he ended up out excelling the class. And math actually is one of his top subjects to this very day. So I thought that was just reminded me of that. And then also the fact that when Freeman discusses the fact that there was so much talent and intelligence within the Cobras that have been stifled, it just made me think of all the genius young black males and females that I had gone to school with who, you know, their lives just you know, weren't worth a damn simply because they were black people in a system of white supremacy. And there's so much that we could be doing and could have done with, as long as this system did not exist, that we're not able to access due to the success of this system of white supremacy. So it really made me think about that very heavily, because it's such a true thing. And even with the people who call in all the time, or even yourself, Gus, you know, we are all just highly intelligent people that if we did not have that barrier, that all pervasive, you know, all 10 areas of people activity, that barrier there, we could be so much more than what we are being allowed to become. On page 124, Mr. Greenlee writes, "Okay, baby," he says, "you're the propagandist. Keep the stuff like this. Ironic, understated, blues things written for black folks. No shit about white devils. Don't give Whitey any stature by screaming what a big bag he is. Put him down and you built him up. The put on is what we want. Keep the themes simple. Few in number, and then work out varieties on those, like in the blues. I found that to be very brilliant." It reminds me of Dr. Welsing. It also reminds me of Neelie Fuller in regards to the name calling and not calling them devils. Just reminded me of the Nation of Islam and the fact that it's very true that when you speak about your enemy, even in a negative way, you do build them up and you give them undue attention for things that they should not be getting attention for. The only attention that they should get is the attention that you need to focus on them to replace the system of white supremacy with justice. So I thought that was really good. And it just puts the focus on what's really important and not the superficiality of name calling. On the following page, he actually writes, "Right, but don't spend too much time denying we're communists. Our people know better, and we really don't care what whites will think. Also, I want you to work out an international propaganda program for distribution to overseas publications in Europe, Africa, and Asia. They're not likely to get our side, from the free, in quotes, white press." This made me think of the importance of black journalism, black media, the importance of black talk radio, and the fact that unless we tell our story, and we can see it happening today in the news and their media publications, they're always going to doctor the truth in a way that obscures reality and puts us in a state of not knowing. And again, like we discussed before, lack of knowledge is actually a form of mental illness. That's what they're trying to facilitate. I just thought that was really brilliant. And it also made me think of, the origins of the first newspaper, which goes back to the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who used to make what we would term newspapers today in the form of scarabs that he would have made up with whatever news and information he wanted the people of Egypt to receive. And he would have people actually scatter them out amongst the countryside from the lowest Egyptian citizen to the noble to get whatever news and information he wanted them to get. And that's the oldest known written form of newspaper that I've been able to find thus far. So I just find that to be very telling. And again, thanks for what you do, Gus, and I'll meet my line there.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in, do you all have commentary you wanted to share?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Ladies first.
Oh, thank you. Oh, brilliant, great breakdown, Ron, of what your observations were. I just wanted to point out in the movie, contrast that to scenes that were omitted. The lead character speaks with this character who is passing, I believe, in his home. And the artwork that describes that he has is Asian. In addition, he is unfortunately having a sexual liaison with a tacky, trashy, and trifling female white woman. Yes. Very interesting that as black as this character proclaims himself to be, as much as he despises passing, quote-unquote passing, as much as he believes he has an understanding of what black people endure and even identifies himself as black. In the book, there is no black woman in his bed, nor is there any black art. However, in the movie, Mr. Greenlee's lead character, when he's with this passing character in his home, the artwork is black. He even pulls a dagger off of the wall while he's speaking to him. I noticed a red, black, and green candle that was burning. There was many African of artwork and African-themed houseware and paraphernalia and things like the artwork in the movie. I also wanted to bring out something that the lead character said to this passing character, which is that, quote, to paraphrase, in the movie he told him he should not be hate. This is not about hating white people. This is reminds me of Dr. Welsing's words exactly, because that's what he said in the movie. I don't know if that's the words that he used in the book, but he did say, because I don't have it in front of me. It says, he said, this is not about hating white people. Something about this is about loving yourself and having enough, quote, paraphrasing, of course, having enough self-respect to want to have more for yourself. Now, Dr. Welsing always said that. However, that is something that I myself personally will admit that I struggle with, is not liking, not hating white people. The more I learn, the less feelings of not hating them that I do have. Even though, you know, we ought to smile and we ought to be courteous and get to the point and be serious with them. Not hating them, and I believe that, you know, that might be an emotion that at times is detrimental for us, but throughout history, when we were less confused and had more of that black nigga pride, I think that anger in many instances served us, especially in the areas of these slave rebellions. And I think about our brothers and sisters in IFD, which is Haiti. I mean, I'm just pronouncing it the way they pronounce it, IFD. That anger with our brother Jean-Jacques Dessalines and La Overture Toussaint and the female, I can't remember the female's name, who helped out as well. That anger has served us. So I'm kind of on the fence about that. This is not about hating white people. But anyway, I just wanted to bring those things out that I observed in the reading. And that's all I had. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that as well. Hope you are taking care of yourself. Sounds like you might have got what Donald Trump had at the debate, I think. The person that dialed in 3637, did you have commentary you were going to share as well, 3637?
Yes, I did. I had commentary about the light skin, the lighter skin character, and I just watched the movie too a couple days ago. And so he is very, very light. And just that it seems like lighter people, they do seem like some of them have issues where maybe somebody feels like they're not black enough, so they have to go really, really hard to show that they're black enough or something. I don't know, but it just seems like I've came across that. And let me see, what else did I have here? The propaganda. I thought that was interesting, and that's very important. They had propaganda, and then he wanted to put out counter propaganda, and then they had international propaganda. So they had pamphlets and stuff to put out, and that stuff is very important. We know that through the media. And I like how they said, don't put them, if you put white people down, you're actually building them up. I agree with that as well. And Let me see here. Oh, I wanted to know, was this movie banned? Did I hear that earlier in the readings?
It was sabotaged deliberately, where they didn't, either it would be in theaters very quickly, it did not get like a full run the way that they did with a lot of other mainstream films that were released at the same time. He talked about how the studio didn't even want to shoot, because they thought it was like a blaxploitation flick. This is like 73, so they thought it was something like Shaft or something like that. And then when they actually saw what it was like, oh man, we don't even really want to show this. There were a lot of efforts to make sure that it did not get the widespread release that films typically do. And then after it was released, it was buried. Like, it was not one of those films that got replayed and showed in syndication on television and things of that nature. And I think it took a long time for it even to come out on, like, DVD. I think that was a relatively recent thing where it kind of got a new shelf, a new life on DVD, where people could watch it and have more availability.
Interesting. It made me think of, I heard some of my older family members were talking about this movie called Battle of Algiers, and I think they said that movie was banned around here too. And not to get off of this one, because this is of course good, but that's another one. Let me see here. What else did I have? Oh, and was this book written before the Turner Diaries or after the Turner Diaries?
This book was written in 69. The Turner Diaries by William Pierce came after this.
Okay. Interesting. That's all the comments that I had. And I like the caller that bought up the color pink. She made me really think about that. I was suspicious about that Victoria's Secrets campaign, too. We were talking about that. But thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thomas in New York, were you going to comment?
The light-skinned character. Yeah, I've noticed what the caller just said. You know, sometimes they go extra because they're light-skinned. It's like they have something to prove. They want to prove their blackness. And sometimes that doesn't play out good, because I have a lot of friends who were light-skinned, and we might even call them pretty, you know, whatever. But they were like the biggest dogs going, you know, like they wanted to go extra to show that, you know, I ain't pretty, you know, I ain't no punk. You know, it was a big deal. And, I don't see that playing out so much as it used to. I hate to give him credit, but the Spike Lee movies, a lot of his earlier works, he dealt with that light skin Boston complex, and I think that did a little, a breaking that ice, at least have the conversation about it, and it's not as prevalent as it was when I was younger. As far as this reading, I like how he's trying to put together his network. You know, it's like putting together, you know, a team when you were growing up. You know, you're going to go play another neighborhood. You're going to get the best players, and you want to put them in certain parts. And, you know, it's sort of very well thought out, very ambitious plan. He has them totally dedicated. And now he's getting to the point where he's, you know, going out to others, and I think it's just playing out brilliantly thus far. As far as the pink thing, just the last thing, you know, I often call, you know, white people PPP, you know, because they either come pink peach or pill, you know. And when you look at them, other than the only white people I've ever met were black. You know, I've grown up with some albinos, and I mean, you would definitely call them whiter than a white person is. So, you know, I think calling them white gives them a lot of credit and a lot of power, because, you know, of the synonyms attached to white, you know, right away, they're great people, they're good people, they're pure people, you know, and nothing could be further from the truth than all of that stuff. I mean, my thank you.
Sure. Did we get everybody who dialed in? Is anybody who did not get an opportunity to share since the second audio segment? Just making sure we didn't miss anybody. Grant, think we got everybody. Some of the quick things, make sure that I get in. Even him being called in his full name, Pretty Willie Dubois. Dubois, I think of W.E.B. Du Bois, and I think even some of the squabbles that went on between he and Marcus Garvey, who was highly melanated, that came to mind immediately just with the last name. But even the first part of his name being Pretty Willie, I think that came up during our last book on Blood Brothers and Muhammad Ali being described as pretty. And I think there was some commentary about that. And is that another form of feminization? And that being talked about both with Muhammad Ali and now thinking about it again in this book with this character being titled Pretty Willie. And is that a part of this backlash and him being so evil because he is thought of in this manner? Same thing I think Thomas in New York mentioned. I think Roz already touched on the portion about how much black genius is ignored or not allowed to blossom because of the system of white supremacy that we're in. Also, the portion, I think this is the end of chapter 10, where he says, Pretty Willie Dubois could be his best fighting commander if he could just find the key to free him from his hang-up about his color. Within a week of the rumble, Freeman thought that he had discovered that key. Reminded me of the full title of Dr. Welsing's work, The Isis Papers, The Keys to the Color. Also a Chicago native, since this book is largely focused in Chicago. When Freeman goes to Pretty Willie to ask him if he could be a propagandist, Sam Greenlee was a propagandist. I thought that was no coincidence at all. He was in the military, and he said that was his job. He was a propagandist, so he's weaving in quite a bit of himself within the novel. The portion where Pretty Willie, when Dan Freeman goes to see him, and he has this white chick there, and when Pretty Willie says that she's a freak, Dan Freeman asks, well, why are you with her? And he says, I like to fuck with her mind. And Freeman responds, looks like you're more shook up than she is. I think that is the case 10 times out of 9, and that's the way I meant to say it, when non-white people are sexually involved with whites. I've heard some victims say that sort of thing, that I just, you know, like messing with them and that sort of thing. It reminds me of a film that came out a while ago, when you think you are messing with someone and they are actually messing with you. My gamble would be that every time the white person is much more aware of this than the non-white person, every time just having an understanding of racism, white supremacy. The use of the term spade in this book came up, particularly it even reminded me of the commentary we heard from a retired firefighter yesterday during workplace racism, where he talked about as a highly melanated black male on the football team that he coaches on, and he's teased, and even it seems some of the older coaches were calling him spade, and he said he spoke up and got people to stop doing that and to call him by his correct name, call him his name, and not making up these other titles and things that are degrading him for having a substantial amount of melanin. Pretty Willie is regularly within this section where they're talking about his propaganda campaign, regularly referencing other black people as spades, even when he's talking about writing poetry about the way that they talk, where he says, I never thought of it that way before, spades singing when they talk. That just kind of stood out to me. Spade has been used other times in the book, but within this portion of the dialogue, it comes up pretty regularly. And to have this light complexion, non-white person who's light enough that they could pass, referring to other black people as spades. And this happens again in the book later in this same chapter, where Pete Dawson, the black police officer, where he also is calling black people spades, where he says that they try to get spade cops in the area to calm things down if there's going to be a riot. I just thought that was interesting, particularly the way the book will evolve with Pete Dawson and even Pretty Willie. But I thought that was interesting use of the employment of the word spade. Let's see, the next thing. I thought it was a really important segment as well when Pretty Willie, Mr. Freeman, they're having their commentary, and Pretty Willie is trying to label him. He says, you know, what are you, a Muslim, a nationalist, a black power advocate, or what? And Dan Freeman says, you know, why do you have to put a label on me? Whitey will do that when all of this goes down. Why can't I just be a man who wants to be free, who wants to walk tall and proud on his own turf as a black man? Why can't it be as simple as that? That brilliant. I think we've had this discussion frequently and coming up with a lot of different titles for us in going about the business of solving this problem. And I think it can be as simple as that. I am a victim of white supremacy, trying to make it so that that is no longer the case. I think it can be as simple as that. See, I also thought it was, again, being serious about this so that we do not take the business of killing lightly, as though this is just fun games and a video game or a movie or something like that. When he asks if you've ever killed someone, he says no. And he says, once you start doing it, it is not going to be fun. This is not something that you're going to enjoy doing. Again, Mr. Greenlee serving in the armed services. Mr. Fuller, I know he's talked about that regularly. Also a veteran. He was in the Korean conflict as well. And taking it seriously and really getting out of the habit that's something that racists have promoted in making killing something to celebrate and to have fun about. I know what Mr. Fuller says consistently, even if you have to kill someone, that that is not cause for celebration. That's not something to rejoice about. If you have to do it, you do what you do and move forward. That we really want to get out of the business of glorifying and making killing fun, which is all racist man, racist woman, racist child. That is central component of white culture. Let's see, where he goes down a little bit further, I certainly could empathize where Pretty Willie asks Freeman. He says, you don't like any of this, do you? And Freeman says, no. And then he gets up to leave and just, this is not, in my view, it is not pleasant. And I would just go to a lot of the black people who have tried to solve this problem and failed, where they have talked about the depression that Dr. King was under, the depression that Minister Malcolm was under, the depression that Rosa Parks was under. I mean, it is a long list. Even Dr. Welsing and the stress that she was under with her housing situation, at least for, I can speak for myself, it is not enjoyable. The business of counter-racism, I think it'll be enjoyable once this problem is solved. But I just appreciate that bit of honesty that came out within the text. Yep, as I said, Pete Dawson, he ends up calling some of the enforcement officials, calling black people spades as well, where he says his plan about riot control is to try to get plainclothes spade cops into the area once it's been sealed off. This, too, seems to be very much a real aspect of the current racist plan. Whenever situation goes down, Ferguson, Charlotte, San Francisco, black enforcement official, Ron Johnson, I'm going to mess his name up, but the black enforcement official with the Charlotte situation in San Francisco, they just fired the chief of police and brought in an interim black police chief because they were having the same issue. They had just killed a black female and had all these text messages where they were calling black people niggers and all this other stuff. That seems to be a major aspect of how things are functioning right now in response to any sort of police shooting or protest, to get as many spade cops in the area as possible to try to calm things down, particularly if you can get what appears to be a spade cop that is in charge, who has some high level of standing, to insert him into the situation to kind of cool things out. And I will stop there. Pretty much did our 3 hours. Unless somebody had something that they can do in like 20 seconds, we should be done. Anybody have anything they needed to get in like 20 seconds? I would assume folks are satisfied. Nothing they need 20 seconds to discuss. Grand. Appreciate everyone's feedback. Great commentary. We'll do it again next Friday, picking up on Chapter 12 next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can check out the video, the movie, rather, is readily available for folks if you want to kind of compare and contrast as we move our way through the text. We will be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what has gone down over the last 7 days. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. The normalization of smoking, that was one thing that stood out to me as well, particularly after the program we did last week. I mentioned it during last week's section, and there was smoking again in this week's section. It seems like cigarette smoking is pretty prevalent in the text. That, again, part of the chemical biological warfare against black people. It just stands out to me more now because of what Dr. Valerie Yeager shared with us last week. I did want to get that in as well. No smoking.
I have a quick question. I'm sorry, I was muted and I didn't get to chime in when you made the last request. I do apologize, but I have a question for you. Is it okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. I was as we were finishing the book reading, I thought about, and I wanted to know if you've ever read the Kenyatta series in Donald Boyne's works, because I was thinking about it, and I know that Donald Boyne's work was written after this book was written, and the Kenyatta character seems to be based on Dan Freeman, a different variation of Dan Freeman, and I wanted to know if you were familiar with him and what you thought of that.
I am not. That's something I'll have to check out. We can add that to our book study list to read down the road. We try to get in at least one piece of fiction per year, so I'll check it out and share a thought or two tomorrow, and we can see if we can add that to the book study session as we ride. With that, I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, cigarettes included, alcohol included, anything else that you can think of, any other narcotics, legal or no, we want to be in our right thinking mind, even again, as the Cobras, as they got better information, more codified, they even lost interest in pot. I think that would be reflected as we become serious about the business of counter-racism and losing interest in all narcotics, drugs, cigarettes, alcohols, and just appreciating being sober, serious soldiers. Certainly, if you're going to be in a vehicle, you do not want to be intoxicated and have that be the day that you bump into Darren Wilson, Daniel Holzclaw, any other race soldier, badge or no. Whites are extremely dangerous. It can be a life-ending, permanently life-altering situation in a matter of seconds. Let's take it seriously. Racism, white supremacy is war being waged against black people in particular, worldwide, every day, all areas of people activity. Our conduct should reflect that at all times. With that, we will conclude. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice. Immediately. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.